Board of Private Post-Secondary Education. It's called to order at 10 a.m. Please remember that the meeting is being audio recorded. The board may go into executive session for the purpose of obtaining legal advice pursuant to ARS 38431.03A3 on any matter on the agenda. The board reserves the right to change the order of the agenda items with the exception of the hearing. Have there been any requests to change the agenda?
No, Madam Chair.
I would like to ask each board member to state their name for the purpose of the recording.
Hank Ratta.
Gordon Tharp.
Craig Jacob.
Mr. Wilder.
I'm sorry, I put myself on mute.
Okay. Thank you.
And Trish Leonard. First, we'll have discussion possible action for IPT Technical Institute. Ms. Stanfield, will you explain?
Yes, Madam Chair. On the reason this matter is before the board is on April 20th, ACICS issued a show cost directive on all IPT campuses. In Arizona, IPT has four campuses licensed. I asked them to provide a response for the board's review and provided to that as well. I also, in my report, I gave you the history that has faced IPT since 2015. Here representing the institution is Brian Gottfriedson, attorney, and on the phone is Sean Crawford, Senior Vice President.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Brian Gottfriedson. I'm with Sachs Tierney. I represent IPT Educational Services. We have on the phone Sean Crawford. He's Senior Vice President with IPT Educational Services. He's in Carmel, Indiana. He was out here about a month ago when we didn't have a meeting, so I didn't make him come out here the 118-degree heat. But he's very capable, and we're happy to be answering any of your questions.
Yes, apologize for our lack of quorum last time. So I want to give you a brief explanation of what's going on?
I think so, and Sean's probably the better person to do that. Sean, are you able to hear us?
I can't hear you. Go ahead. What was the question?
A brief explanation. We have read the materials provided. Would you like to give a recap?
So the only thing I can supplement is that we had a show cause response that was due on June 15th. We did submit that in a timely manner. It was a very comprehensive response. We believe that we were able to evidence that we are fully in compliance with ACICS's accreditation standards. And the current status, of course, with ACICS and their own recognition process has added some complexity to the situation, but we are scheduled to appear before the council on August 2nd in person to address the show cause and fully anticipate that our appearance will be successful.
Any discussion from members of the board?
Is there any update on the SEC investigation, or is that still in process?
On the SEC investigation, Sean, is there any update?
There's been no change with respect to any of the material litigation. We continue to be in ongoing and regular contact with the Department of Ed. Conjunction with the SEC case, we're in ongoing discussions of a strategic nature as to how to address the SEC concerns. As we've publicly communicated, we fully disagree with the SEC finding that there was sufficient merit to move forward with their with their lawsuit, but we are fully responding and again the same and to vigorously defend ourselves and work through the process.
Okay, thank you. Do you know when you'll hear back from ACICS on your show cause response?
We won't have a, their next executive committee meeting is July 15th. We are going to prepare an interim update for the council at that time, and that'll reflect anything that develops in the the interim between the June 15th submission and 30 days later. But no, they acknowledged receipt. We confirmed that. We had provided a copy to their counsel, legal counsel. But until we appear before them in a formal hearing on August 2nd, I don't expect any kind of a substantive communication back.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other comments?
No. The additional LOC that's required by the department, when is that due? When is that due?
So there was we had contacted Mr. Frola after receipt of his letter. We are in ongoing discussions with education, Department of Education, as to the calculation of that amount and the manner of payment. As we previously updated, we were originally required to post the letter of credit. We sufficiently received permission from Ed to transition that to an escrow account. There is a question as to how that amount, the additional surety amount, is calculated. And again, the same as we have done with the Education Department all along, we report biweekly to them about our cash flows and distributions. We are on Take the Cash Monitoring 1, so they receive student rosters and have to approve every person of total four money for our students. And we don't have an official response back from Ed as of this morning when I met with our CEO, but we are discussing with them again both the amount and the form that the additional surety would take.
Okay, thank you.
How's it going with the submission?
With the submissions to the Department of Education?
Yeah.
Yeah, we provide six different reports to the Department of Education on an ongoing basis. We just filed our 52nd update yesterday. Maybe it was the 53rd. I think the 52nd was a request for additional information. So to date, we have filed 52 unique reports and submissions to them and have not received any substantive feedback or request for correction. What they have done is, as we've gone through the process, we have had additional requests tacked on or requests for additional information. We've just continued to fully, be transparent with the Department of Education.
How many students do you have?
I would share with you last time I was out there last year, we had a similar discussion around the department, and I would reinforce that it is an extremely collaborative and cooperative relationship at this point. Continue to be in weekly, if not more frequent contact with both Michael Frola of the Multi-Region and Foreign School Participation Division, and then I regularly communicate with Andrew Lawrence as well, who is in charge of our electronic application relating to our 2-main campus.
How many students do you have in Arizona? And sort of what's the state of the students, vis-a-vis all of this? How are the students doing? What are you hearing from your faculty and
staff? Yeah, so there's been, I don't know the number of students. I'm more than willing to get that for you. I just don't know that off the top of my head. There has been very little feedback from students, either positively or negatively. We did have students, quite frankly, from each of our campuses that prepared written comments. Students to campuses were invited ahead of the NISTICI meeting, which is scheduled for 2 days from now, where ACICS is obviously up for their recognition with the advisory committee to provide written comments. And we actually had a number of students, and off the top of my head, I don't know whether any of them are actually from Arizona, either current residents or former graduates, but we have, I want to say it's between 8 and 12 employers and students attending in person to provide testimony to NISTICI. But in addition to that, when the solicitation for written comments went out, we had a number of students from every one of our campuses across the country provided letters, written letters attesting to the quality of the education they were receiving with the ITC Technical Institutes. And I'd be more than happy to share the letters from the Arizona students with the board.
Dr. Rada, there's about 2,400. I did a list of all the ACICS schools and 12,000 students.
Any other comments by the board?
No.
I would like to make a motion for action or no action.
Well, I mean, I want to continue to follow this, so I don't know. Do we have a complaint open, or how are we doing that?
No, we could keep them on reporting, so to speak, that we have what we have done. We requested them to provide us with updates as they happen, which Emily Reams has been very diligent in giving me updates as they are provided, and then we could schedule them before. You said you go before ACICS in August?
August 2nd.
So we could ask for an update for the August meeting, which is, I think, August 25th.
So then I make a motion so that we continue to direct ITT to give us real-time updates as they're happening with in regard to the ACICS show cause directive and the SEC investigation, as well as appear before the August 20th board meeting to give us an update on the in-person meeting with ACICS.
Okay, your motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? That motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is the Art Institute of Phoenix. Ms. Campbell, can you just give us a comment?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. On May 4th, 2016, ACICS issued a financial show cause directive at several institutions owned by EDMC. One of those institutions was the Art Institute of Phoenix. Therefore, I request that EDMC provide a response for the board's review and discussion possible action. The response was provided to you, and please, if you would, please note that the financial protections are confidential, as EDMC is a publicly traded company. All of the documents were in your file, and here representing the institution is Chad Williams, campus director, and also on the phone, Tricia Earle, Senior VP of Accreditation, and Frank DeLuca, CFO.
Yep, that's correct.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Chad Williams.
Good morning.
I'm the campus president at the Art Institute of Phoenix, and as indicated, I'm joined by two of my EDMC colleagues on the phone. And I think Tricia is prepared to make any opening comments.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Perfect.
Okay. Great. And just as a housekeeping matter, we had originally requested to go into executive session because of the projected earnings and forecasted information. However, if there's not going to be any detailed questions about those projections, we probably won't need executive session. And I'd be happy to just speak to everything else regarding the ACICS financial show cause. Does that sound appropriate just to proceed?
Mr. Waller, do you have any questions that we would need to go into executive session to have them answer?
Mr. Waller?
I don't believe so, but if we went into executive session, would we have a forum?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we'd
need
you, wouldn't we?
Okay, then. We will just get that right.
Everybody else can call back on the same number. Yeah. I have a special note, but I don't have a name. Okay.
Well, no. Then we have to lose the EDMC representative.
Oh, that's right. Never mind.
Okay, well, we will forego this at the time. If it turns out that we need additional information, we will come up with a solution.
Okay.
Okay. All right, then I'll just provide an overview of the response to the show cause. I would note that it was a financial show cause only, and it was based, according to the ACICS letter, it was based or predicated on the worsening financial condition of AI York, which is in York, Pennsylvania. This is one of the five ED&C institutions accredited by ACICS. AI Phoenix, who is before you today, was a part of the show cause, but the show cause was solely based on AI York. I should note that AI York has been in teach-out since May 2015, so it is naturally unprofitable. The campus is conducting the teach-out of this campus in an orderly, well-planned, and responsible fashion. I would note that the teach-out plan calls for this campus to be open 3+ years so that we could see all the bachelor's students out through graduation. So it's actually an indication of AI's and ED&C's commitment to fund this teach-out in such a fashion. So as we anticipated, a teach-out being conducted like this is not profitable. We don't believe reviewing the performance of one institution currently being taught out, we believe it doesn't present an accurate picture of the strength of our other institutions. Moreover, it doesn't take into account the funds that ED&C brings to bear to support these teach-outs in a responsible fashion. Nonetheless, we are confident that we're going to respond to the ACICS's show cause request. Our response is due June 30th, and we will be providing voluminous documents to answer their concerns, and we're confident we'll be found to be in compliance with their accreditation standards when that hearing occurs in August. Moreover, I would like to note that since this packet of material was presented, there has been a further development which we have shared with Ms. Stanfield, and that is there are actually four campuses accredited by ACICS in Arizona, AI Phoenix, BMC Phoenix, AI Tucson, and BMC Tucson. Three of those four campuses have now been put into teach-out, and we shared that with Ms. Stanfield, I think, 2 weeks ago, the formal notification of the teach-out. So there's only one ACICS accredited institution that is not in teach out that's going forward and is a viable institution, and that's the Art Institute of Phoenix, which, as you've seen in the packet of material, is a quite profitable campus. Are there any questions I can answer at this point regarding any of these matters?
So you mentioned the Phoenix campus is quite profitable, but I did see in here that you're going to be doing some right-sizing. Can you explain how severe that the impact will be on that right-sizing on the campus?
Chad, do you have that information? Well, I would note that is not occurred yet, so it's highly confidential.
Yes.
Chad, could you just speak to the number?
Yeah,
you anticipate?
The number I anticipate is going to be 8 individuals, no faculty. It is largely at the executive level, combining some management areas, but that's the expected impact.
Okay, and what's your total staffing?
Total faculty and staff? I would have to get you the total staffing number. I don't recall it off the top of my head.
Okay.
Since some of the difficulty is based on one campus being in teach-out, and if you now will have 3 additional in teach-out, have you discussed that with the accreditor of how that's going to continue to make it appear that you're less profitable?
Absolutely. Well, that will be a part of our submission to ACICS on June 30th, but we've had that verbal conversation with them, and we are fully committed to funding those teach-outs appropriately. And yes, we understand that in the short term it would cause some natural expense, but we think in the long term it really positions us well for future operations. And we've had that discussion with ACICS. It's part of the narrative response we'll be providing to them on June 30th. And I think they appreciate it. Appreciate the willingness to bear the expense, but also the willingness to take care of the students, to make sure that we aren't closing the doors precipitously, We are putting articulation agreements in place for those students who want to transfer, but we're not forcing them to transfer. And I think ACICS's response to that has been that they appreciate that approach to handling a teach-out.
Out of curiosity, are students being offered or allowed to accelerate to go day and evening or something to finish earlier?
Absolutely. We are offering acceleration paths. Now, for the Brown-Mackey campuses, it was just announced 2 weeks ago, so we're working through that. But for the AI campuses and teach-out, that is an option. There's also an option to go online, and online is a regionally accredited institution. So we're trying to put as many options in front of students as possible.
Okay. And I actually do have the staffing numbers if you'd like them. It's 24 full-time faculty, 68 part-time faculty, and 74 staff members.
Thank you.
Yes.
Ms. Stanfield, are they on the financial reporting with us?
No. Because the institution here has been...
Yeah, I understand why. I just wanted to know if they're there. I mean, Phoenix, but now we have three additional schools that are in teach-out mode, so I don't know. Well, we know what it's going to look like, so I don't know if it's worth the time.
Well, and unfortunately, quorum issues have prevented the finance committee from being able to meet.
I'm aware.
I know you don't represent Brown-Mackey, but with the teach-out at Brown-Mackey, is any issues so far with losing affiliations with clinical sites for your students to complete their programs with their, if you have externships and things like that?
We have not experienced that yet. We just announced the teach-out. I think it's not even been a week yet, has it? I said 2 weeks. I think we're going on a week now. So we haven't experienced that yet.
Okay.
And we hope not to. We hope to work very hard not to, to lose that opportunity.
Any other questions? Do I hear a motion for action or non-action?
Well, I mean, I think I'd
entertain
the same type of motion we did for the last school, which is make
so
a motion
that they know.
Well, make a motion that we continue to receive real-time updates from you as you get them from ACICS. Also, that you appear in front of the August 20th board meeting and give us a update as to your in-person meeting with the ACICS.
And just a correction, 25th.
I think we need to include how the teach-out is going. Yeah.
Well, I just think teach-out plans have to be submitted to the state anyway, don't they? Okay. I mean, so that's...
Like an update on the student counts and how it's...
Oh, that's all inclusive, yeah. But he's with the Art Institute, and they're not teaching out, so I don't know that that's an appropriate addition to this motion.
That's a good question. Want to recap that motion?
No.
So report the report to the office. An update. What's going on with ACIS? Make sure that we receive the teach-out plans.
Well, again, I think we need to back up. He represents the Art Institute, and he's not in teach-out. So I don't think he can give us anything that has to do with that. So to restate my motion, the Art Institute gives us real-time updates with what's happening with ACICS and their directive on the financial show costs, okay? And then reappear here on the August 25th board meeting after your in-person meeting with ACICS to give us an update on how that meeting went and stuff like that.
I'll second that motion.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? And motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is Tucson College. Ms. Stanfield, can you give us a recap?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. On May 4th, 2015, 2016, ACICS issued a financial show cause directive on Tucson College and three other institutions that are owned by Delta Career Education Corporation. On May 12th, the department issued a letter to DCEC regarding the requirement of provisional certification and an LOC alternative. Both copies of those letters were attached. Tucson College has been on quarterly reporting since 2013. The board did approve the 2016 regular vote and degree granting license at your December 8th, 2015 meeting with the stipulation to maintain the $453,000 surety bond and to continue quarterly reporting. All the information was provided to you in the electronic file. And here representing the institution is Dennis Chavez. Tucson College Campus President Ned Snyder, VP of Operations. Charles Brisman, who is counsel on the phone.
Bill Nance, Chief. Bill Nance,
our Chief Operating Officer, and Katrina Van Atta, who is our Vice President and Controller, are also on the phone.
Thank you.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, I'm Dennis Chavez, the Campus Director at Tucson College.
Ned Snyder, President of Online Operations for Delta.
Okay. Which one of you is going to be the spokesperson to give us a little update?
Actually, Ms. Stanfill and members of the board, if I might start, rather than my colleagues in person, and they can certainly jump in if that would be satisfactory with the board and with Ms. Stanfill.
Certainly.
So we're before you today, as Ms. Stanfill summarized, because of two developments, and if I might address the Department of Education's letter of credit first, because I think that's easily put to one side. We did indeed receive what, from our standpoint, is an annual notification from the Department of Education regarding our provisional certification requirements and the need as part of those requirements to post a letter of credit with the department. We have received this notice annually since 2007. It was a requirement of the change of control of Delta at that time. This is when Griffin Investors became the controlling stockholder of the Delta family of schools. I don't mean to diminish the significance of provisional certification, but from our standpoint, this is an annual development. And this year's development was a reduction of the letter of credit that we are required to post. For the last year, we have had a $40.4 million letter of credit posted with the department. As a result of this year's notification, the size of the letter of credit was reduced to $35.5 million. And coincidentally, we delivered that letter of credit just yesterday to the department. As part of provisional certification, Tucson College and the entire Delta family of schools are on HCM1, and that too has been the case since 2007. I'm happy to go into that history and the annual notification in greater detail, but as I said, from our standpoint, that was not a new development when compared to the ACICS financial show cause directive.
Would you like to add anything?
No, ma'am.
Questions to members of the board?
In your letter to ACICS on May 6th, where you confirm the show cause directive, you state that you're going to align your cost structure, modernize our program portfolio and student experience for long-term viability of the institution. What have you done in regards to that so far?
Well, we've actually had 11 applications approved for new programs. We've got 6 associate's programs and 5 diploma programs. And that's pending approval from the Department of Education to convert us from semester credit to quarter credit. That application's been with them approximately 13 months, and we're told it would take anywhere from 12 to 18 months for that approval.
That's why you want to switch that? Why do you want to do that switch?
Switch?
From semester credit to
semester
quarter.
And quarter.
The rest of the programs that are taught in Delta are quarter credits, so that's to align us with our parent company.
And do you have a plan of how you're going to convert? Because it's not all that easy to do.
No, it's not. And we're actually working on it now.
Yep. We prepared for a lot of effort.
Ms. Stanfill, members of the board, we, as Dennis described, the matter in this conversion has been, while it's still within the department's expected time frame, the matter has been pending for a while. The overarching goal was to align Tucson College's academic calendar and delivery with the rest of the Delta family. That produces, as you can imagine, some efficiencies and cost savings across the family. The actual conversion process is labor-intensive, but given the size of the college and the relatively compact portfolio, and particularly given the time available, that has been entirely feasible so far, and we are not anticipating too much in the way of implementation noise.
I'm a little bit concerned if you think that it is very complicated from a Title IV perspective. Depending on how you're doing it, if you're having students, say, complete an academic year under one system and then funding forward under the Porter system, or if you're letting students finish out in the current program, in the current semesters. Otherwise, everyone has a transfer student, so they're funded for one semester, and then now you have to do an academic year combining semesters and quarters. It's not easily done. And so the thing with financial aid is that it's very easy for the people who don't have to do it, and it's very hard for the people who do. And so I hope that you are considering that the amount of work it's going to take for your staff to actually process the financial aid on this is considerable, and don't downplay it and be prepared to offer that, or you're going to have a lot of dissatisfied students. You can end up with, over the same period of time, when you're switching from semesters to quarters, students can lose money because, three quarters versus two semesters. So if they got 50%, now they're doing two more semesters, they lose out on money because it would equal more than 100%. So make sure that you have your financial aid experts truly looking at and understanding how much work is involved, do the cost analysis to determine what loss the student in aid is going to be, and how are you going to satisfy the students for that. Are you going to give scholarships of some sort to accommodate for the difference, or institutional loans with similar benefits as a department? Just really think about it and understand it's not going to be easy.
No, all points very well taken, and had I anticipated this line, our colleague Scott Burr, who is our Vice President of Centralized Financial Services, would have joined us today. As I said, points all very well taken. Given the affected student population of about 250 students, I think we are confident we can make individualized assessments of each of those students and then craft a transition plan, and where necessary, because the issue of reduced eligibility is absolutely real, where we can make appropriate adjustments to make sure students in terms of financial aid profile and potential out-of-pocket are absolutely whole as that transition takes place.
Thanks. I'd just like to remind you that we do have a complaint committee, and we don't want to see you there again.
No, I very much appreciate that.
Okay.
And Ms. Stanfill, this is Bill Nance. I'll add that Scott Berg and myself have both completed this transition in the past at other institutions, and certainly don't diminish the amount of effort and the fact that, to Mr. Grissom's point, it is a by-student transaction process where we make sure every student is addressed individually because it is a unique situation for each one. So the duration of the programs, the size of the campus, and other factors around the way we intend to implement new programs at the same time while we're effectively teaching out the existing programs gives us comfort, but we're not going in assuming there won't be a significant amount of effort involved. We fully expect that.
Well, it's good to have people who've already gone through it. As I said, it, in theory, it seems easier than it's going to be in actual doing the work.
Can you, Mr. Travis, what's your head, your student population? I'm confused because we saw 578, 250, and then your projections through June 30th, 2016 on your financials show 364.
Right now we have 170 active students and 46 provisional students for a total of 216.
What's a provisional student? I'm sorry.
A provisional student is a student first 28 calendar days of their school. We give the students the opportunity to determine if Tucson College is the place they want to be. If it's not in that first 28 days, we can cancel their enrollment. They leave free and clear.
Okay. And you do officially accept them from provisional to?
Yeah. Yes.
So what is, this hasn't been a good year financially. What's the strategy moving forward? Are we going to, looks like, I'm just wondering how long you can survive at this rate.
Yeah, I have a similar question, just to, not to go into details in financials, but you show it's a pretty significant loss. Delta shows a real significant loss, so my 10,000-foot question is, where's the funding? How long can we sustain this?
Okay, and I'm going to refer that to Mr. Nance and Mr. Brisk.
So, Ms. Stanfield, members of the board, Tucson College, as part of a family of 35 Title IV eligible campuses that Delta operates, in some ways can benefit from being part of the larger whole. The observation on Delta Career Education's Corporation's consolidated financial performance is absolutely correct. We have said in similar contexts previously and continue to note that for a leveraged organization like Delta, the impact of non-cash expenses is significant, and that net income as reported on a GAAP basis often presents a dramatically different and less appealing picture than is actually the case. The Delta family continues to have sufficient liquidity and a game plan for stabilizing and growing, and for Tucson in particular, the conversion to quarter systems, the addition of new programs, and it's benefiting from centralized initiatives that run the gap from portfolio optimization and admissions and enrollment process improvements, we think does get Tucson and Delta pointed in the right direction, even on a GAAP basis, over the next fiscal year.
Okay, thank you.
I guess if I might add, what you're seeing, of course, we believe is exactly what ACICS is looking at when it issued us the financial show cause directive. We can't help but note, and I say this with gratitude to the representatives from the Art Institute who preceded us in the meeting, can't help but note that 19 institutions got financial show cause directives on May 4th. That's coming out of ACICS's April meeting. In the prior year's worth of meetings at ACICS, a grand total of 4 institutions had received financial show cause directives. So while the need to respond effectively to ACICS is real, and we will do so, we can't help but feel that we have been swept up into the understandable cyclone of action that ACICS has brought upon itself as it fights for its recognition life. I say that only by way of context. Our response will be absolutely addressing what the council has noted. Some of you may recall that Tucson College itself received a financial show cause directive last year from ACICS. We made a written submission, appeared in person, and the show cause directive was vacated. We are a year further down the road, but we're also a year further down the road in a number of centralized enhancements that we think do benefit the entire Delta family of schools.
Well, I agree with your statement that you're swept up in this. That's partially true, but this is not a specific to ACICS. It's ACCSC has up their financials. AAB, ABHES, all of them have. And the reason is because it was an area they probably weren't as good at. And what we see, and especially from a consumer protection board, and why we're so interested in your liquidity and how you can move forward, is we've seen unprecedented closures, and not the good way, where there's a teach-out plan, where staff and students show up on a Monday and the doors are chained. And so it is very big deal to us where that we do get good exposure from you all on this, because we don't want to be dealing with that anymore. And we understand the times, the unfairness, and maybe a lot that's come down, but we do, where this might be a sweeping action, the financials paint a picture where it does cause concern, and that's my editorial.
Completely understandable and completely fair. We read the headlines along with everyone else in higher education, and particularly the proprietary sector of higher education, and are very much saddened by what's going on. As a general statement, all I can tell you that the management team and the board and the stockholders of Delta are absolutely focused on these developments and these phenomenon. The board's meeting today just happens to be in this unfortunate interim period between our initial response to ACICS and our written submission, which begins on June 30th. So the entirety of how we propose to address the financial show cause directive isn't yet before you. It will be before you as soon as it's delivered to ACICS. And as you may have seen from the show cause directive, there'll be a supplemental written submission in July. We too will be appearing before ACICS in person in August. The representative from ITT referred to an August 2nd appearance. We have not had that date confirmed for us yet, but undoubtedly it will be during the council's August meeting, which stretches over 2 weeks, I think, this year. And we will certainly, as we would be doing even without formal action by the board, we would be updating Ms. Stanfill in her office coming out of that appearance. And then, of course, as soon as we receive ACICS's written reaction to our in-person appearance. That generally is a full 30 days before we see the written reaction.
Okay, thank you for that.
That may well be mid-September.
All right, thank you. Fair enough.
For a little bit of discussion, history has shown us that sometimes when we have been a little more lenient on the school because they were working really hard and giving us a lot of updates, and then we got the notice that they were closing anyway, so we are a little bit gun-shy when it comes to that. But at the same time, I personally wouldn't want to add extra burden that you end up taking time to do things for us that takes away from what you need to do for the accrediting. So we had some choice of actions that we could take. I would like to propose for discussion that we have them come back in 3 months and give us all these updates, but reevaluate at that point whether we should ask for a teach-out and put them on quarterly reporting and such like that to give them a chance to breathe.
They're already on reporting, though, just, you know, on financial reporting.
Okay.
Quarterly, so I would want to leave them on that.
Yeah. We very much appreciate that sentiment and those remarks. If we are in a position to make a formal ask, our ask is that there be no additional action requested by the board at this time. As the conversation noted, the college is currently on quarterly reporting with the board. Our ACICS submissions come to Ms. Stanfill's office as a matter of course, and that will be the case with all of our submissions in response to the show cause directive. And I think it's not until our in-person appearance that, frankly, either we or anyone else are really in a good position to know what should happen next. And I think that for the board, and we have other state higher education authorities looking as well, what we submit to ACICS is absolutely what we would submit to individual state higher education authorities to answer all of the same questions. So our desire is that that information flow be allowed to continue through the in-person appearance at least, before the board or any other individual state higher education authority considers additional actions or requests.
Seems fair to me. I mean, the only additional thing that I want to see is I want to request, which is not just the Finance Committee, but I want an in-person appearance after the meeting after the sit with ACICS to give us an in-person update. That's the only additional.
August or?
Well, I'm not sure. They haven't had a confirmed date, so my thing would be when their confirmed date is in, then the board meeting right after that, yes. So I'm thinking August 25th is going to be fine because I know that they're meeting at the beginning of August. So although not confirmed yet, if that meeting does happen, then I would be in favor. I mean, I'm open for discussion, but I would be in favor of them returning this group in presenting to the full board what happened and kind of discuss the response, because we'll have had time to digest the response at that point and look at it and see where we go. And more action may or may not be born out of that. I have no idea until we see it, you know.
And, again, because we've been short, our next Finance Committee would be in September, which may or may not happen.
Again, I think it's important. I agree with that, but they stay on reporting, and that's not a question. No change. I just think it's important they appear in front of the full board after that's it.
Well, if the Finance Committee is not going to have a quorum by then, do we have to do that as a special request to have them present their financials to the full board instead of just the committee?
Well, what we would be able to do, if this is the case, is what they give me is due August 15th to the Finance Committee, that I would be able to provide to the full board if you're requesting an update, which is kind of where I was trying to go.
Yes, that's where, definitely.
The Finance Committee, I don't know if we'll be okay by September. No.
Fair enough.
Mr. Waller, did you want to make any other comments?
No.
Thank you. I just on the last point, and saying this very much with a smile on my face, appreciating the various procedural issues the board has to juggle there. You tell us when you want us in person, and I can assure you, Mr. Nance, Ms. Van Atta, myself, anyone else you want to see in person, along with Mr. Snyder and Mr. Chavez, we will be there.
Are we ready to make a motion?
I am. Make a motion that, again, and it's going to be similar, that you keep us updated with real-time updates that you provide, which you will, and require the submission to ACICS for the show cause response, and that you reappear in person, the three of you. You're fine on the phone, Mr. Brisman. I appreciate all your input today. To give us an update on what took place with your in-person meeting with ACICS.
Yes.
And I would direct the board to please distribute to the full board the financial reporting document, the quarterly reports that the Tucson College submits for our review.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Don't make me repeat it.
No, we won't do that.
We have a motion. We will not have to have repeated. And a second. So we'll call for vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Danville, members of the board. Thank you very much.
Take at least a couple minutes of pause here before the. is the Arizona School of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. Ms. Cantwell, will you give us a summary?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Arizona School of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine is seeking renewal of the 2016 residency and regular vocational program license. The board did place Payson on probation in May of 2015. In my report, I provided to you the chronological summary. Also, for this renewal, the board had requested they provide a listing of the board of directors, the org chart, a copy of the PPA and the LOC, and a strategic plan. We then had scheduled it for the May meeting, and we postponed it at the May meeting because we had not yet received the strategic plan or audit, and we have since received it from that time, as well as Mr. Holland provided you the other information request. Here representing the institution is Alex Holland, president, and Stephanie Hugh, who is the owner, and I'm sorry, I don't know.
My name's Adrian Hall. I'm a board member, and I'm an attorney here in Arizona.
So, give us a brief update of what's going on.
My name is Alex Holland, president, and we got the summary that I thought would be helpful in trying to educate the board in terms of where the school has been and what it's been dealing with for the last year and a half or so. So currently, the school is still on probation with the Accreditation Commission. We have a site visit. I just handed in the self-study to the Accreditation Commission on June 1st.
Did Ms. Stansfield get a copy of that?
I've been trying to get it to her. And it has been rather comical, but she will be getting one shortly, as soon as the computers start cooperating.
The computers weren't cooperating, so he is going to bring it on a CD or flash drive.
That's fine. I just want to make sure we see it.
Yes. And they have scheduled a site visit for this fall. There are 9 noncompliances. 4 of those noncompliances need to be remedied at this site visit. And I believe that those 4 will easily be remedied at this site visit. And I'm hopeful that that will bring the school off of probation. So that's basically a very brief summary in addition to what had been presented to you.
We normally assign one lead to work with a school's package, but as you've been a frequent flyer here,
yes,
it was spread out a bit. So we'll start with David with the financials.
Okay, I just have a couple of what I hope are friendly questions. Thank you for providing us with auditor's financial report. I don't have any questions about the financial reports themselves. They seem to be in good order. The concern, of course, is that you are operating at a loss. And that takes us to the strategic plan. And if everything goes well as the strategic plan lays out, then the school will be very profitable. But my concern is, I'm going to start with the marketing plan. Over the next 2 years, if I'm reading things correctly, and I'd like you to address this, you're moving from approximately 25 students today to 47 students 2 years from now. So in the course of 2 years, the campus is basically going to double in size. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes.
Help me understand. I'm not finding that projection credible, is the bottom line. And I'm hoping you can disabuse me of my conservative nature, if you will. But we've been working together now for a number of years, and I haven't seen anywhere near that kind of growth in the past. And I'm not seeing anything in the marketing plan that would would cause me to believe that you're going to be able to double the size of the school in that short of a time. So what's different this time, I guess, is what I'm asking. How is it that you're planning on actually acquiring those additional students?
One of the things that occurred when the school was recently bought was that the school lost its federal financial aid eligibility. This impacted the school significantly in terms of student enrollment for the last year. Eligibility has been reinstituted. As a result, projections for this coming fall are actually looking quite good. And we're assuming that by this fall, we will probably have up to 30 to 32 students at the school, because that's what we're seeing in terms of the people who are potentially enrolling. With that in conjunction with the two schools merging, will result in faculty not being paid twice for teaching the same courses. Because as it currently stands, Han University, which is in the same building, is not financially aid eligible. The Arizona school is financially aid eligible. And the two schools cannot blend their students clinically or didactically. As a result, the school spends a little bit too much money hiring two different teachers to teach the same courses at the same institution under the same roof in order to maintain compliance with federal financial aid. We are planning to have Han University be able to provide further financial aid within, we're hoping, 6 to 8 months, possibly by this fall. We have applied.
Stop you there. Okay, yes. You did apply?
Yes.
What?
We applied, I think it was like April, and they requested more information. We provided that information about 2 weeks ago. It's the last bit of information they needed. They wanted to see the allocation of what finances are spent between the two schools. Groundskeeping, you know, everything. And so we went through everything and determined what each school is spending. And so that was the last little bit of information that they were looking at receiving, theoretically, before they make their decision. Now, at the same time, the owner of the school, as we are sitting here in Phoenix, he's relaxing in Denver, where the temperatures are much nicer, doing a federal financial aid workshop to, again, facilitate the movement forward for HOG.
Who's that, John?
It's John.
Yeah.
And between the increase in projected enrollments, which we're seeing are looking actually pretty good, and the hopefulness that the schools can actually merge in terms of didactic and clinic, that will assist in terms of the financial projections for the Arizona school. We also have been looking at recruiting students from China as well. We have developed a tag program with Pima Community College, so the students entering, if they want to come to the Arizona school or Han after 2 years, you know, that's something that we have arranged with them. So there are different things that we're doing to not only promote the school internally, but actually doing talking with like the College of Nursing, find out how do we contact nurses that have graduated. So we're developing a strategy for marketing to nurses who have graduated who may want to continue their education. So there are a lot of different kinds of strategies that we're using. Some of them are playing out sooner than later, but we are hopeful that we can become profitable and that the student enrollment will increase as according to the strategic plan. That's the best we can do. Is everything we can do. Stephanie, do you have anything?
Okay, so you're hoping to have 35 students this fall.
30 to 35.
Between 30 and 35?
Yes.
How many of those would be returning students?
Let's see. The returning students would probably be close to 18 to 20. So we're looking at...
So we're expected to add another 10 to 12?
Yes.
Okay. And of that 10 to 12, here we are two-thirds of the way through June, mm-hmm. How many have actually applied?
I would say of that 10 to 12, probably 4 to 6. A couple of them are transfer students from other schools, which will bolster the students that are already second and third year students, and probably 4 to 5, so probably about 7 or 8 have already applied, and probably 4 or 5 of those are new, and 3 are transfer. That's currently where we stand, and we've got another 2.5-3 months, so we get applications, not applications, but inquiries on a daily basis, and there are probably about 12 to 13 students already who have started sending us their information, but they have not been accepted because we don't have all their admissions materials.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Abbott?
Which of the 4 criteria from accreditation that have to be fixed by the visit out of the 9?
So the first one was, criteria 4. It's like admission, not admissions, it's administration. And it's kind of like, when they did their site visit last year in November, the administration was relatively new. And so they didn't know how to assess appropriately the ability of the administration to function. When they do their site visit this coming November, those people will have been in their jobs for a little over a year and a half. So they will be able to appropriately assess. And they actually say in their site visit report and in the action letter by the Accreditation Commission that it was unassessable. The same thing holds true for academic leadership, because the academic dean had only been on the job for about 4 months. And so by the time they do the site visit, he will have been at the job for probably about a year and a half. So his academic leadership would be able to be appropriately assessed, and I think he's doing a great job. The other two were basically assessment. Is the school appropriately assessing what it needs to assess in order to close the loop to bring about an improvement in not only the academics, but the structure, the administration, the faculty, the records, all those different kinds of components that make a school what it is. And so we have developed an institutional, systematic assessment strategy and protocol that we are employing and documenting everything so that we can demonstrate to the Accreditation Commission that, yes, we are assessing the program in all aspects of the program.
Let me try it this way. I'm just trying to get to a couple of simpler questions without diving through all the accreditation. Would you agree with this, that one of the major areas when the issues, the bylaws, administration, chief administration, it's really administrative leadership. So what's changed in terms of the administrative leadership, the dedication of people to ensure that, it's running according to your plan, classes occurring, faculty are staffed, folks know who to go to in terms of any administrative issues. So it's really the administration of the university. What's different now than 6 months ago?
I would say that the president of the school, who's had 25 years administrative experience in academics, traditional Chinese medicine schools, has been on the job. When they did the last visit, I was on the job for about 48 hours.
Okay.
When they did the site visit. And so it's kind of like, how can you tell?
How much time are you dedicating to the?
About 25 hours a week.
Okay.
And also the academic dean, the academic dean has been, he's been very good in terms of establishing credibility in the administration.
How long has he been there?
He's been there now a little over, about a year.
And did he have prior academic dean experience?
He hadn't had prior academic dean experience, but he had been a clinic dean at the same school for a few years back. So he knew the ropes in terms of appropriate administration of academic protocols.
Okay. And the next on your chart is an administrator. Do you have somebody in that position?
Administrator?
Yeah. I'm just looking at your org chart and going through the top line.
We have a gal who's been an administrator. She has been there probably almost a year, and she is also our registrar. So she's been doubling on those two positions. So she's been there about a year.
Okay, dean of students, do you have one of those?
We don't have a dean of students.
Are you looking for, or is that?
Not at this point. And I think one of the things that would be really interesting is the woman who's the administrator and the registrar has a really good way of working with people, and especially students. And I think that we might eventually look at moving her into the registrar dean of students position and find another administrator. But that's not going to be in the near future.
Okay. Is the accountant your FA person, or is that finance you're talking, and the accountant on your...
Stephanie, accountant.
I'm just looking just to make it your
duty
plan.
Yeah, we have an accountant named Danny, but he works like with a team.
It's a company.
Yeah.
So that's outsourced.
Yes.
I don't see financial aid. Am I missing it? But I don't see financial aid anywhere in your chain of command. Your board of directors.
Board of directors?
I mean, not board of directors. Your org chart is the word I was trying to say.
The org chart should have our FFA director and the...
Interesting. It's here on this one.
Okay. It's not on this one. This is older then. Okay.
Yeah, so...
Is that filled, that position?
Yeah. So our financial aid director has had about 30 years of experience in terms of dealing with federal financial aid. And about 6 months ago, we hired a financial aid administrator to work under her.
Okay, good.
And the financial aid administrator has taken the online courses for federal financial aid and is planning to do the workshop that John is currently doing in order to bring her up to speed in terms of all the nuances of federal financial aid.
Is your FA director, she on site with
them? She comes to the school once a week for one day.
Okay, yeah, that was my concern last time, and I'll just continue to raise that as a concern, financial aid being so complicated, so specialized, and the person who really sits there is pretty green without that daily on-campus supervision. I worry about that. Okay.
So let me say this about that.
Okay, thanks. You knew I was going to ask, didn't you?
We actually have an FFA director. We've been doing that for 7 or 8 years.
Right.
And we're moving her out of that position. But she is there on a daily basis work with the new financial aid administrator. And the financial aid director is in constant phone contact with the newbie as well.
Great. One question, because I shanghaied his thing. I'm sorry about that. I was the clinical director. Is that Phil?
Yes, we've got a clinical director. He's got at least 28 years of academic experience, and he's been the director for Hahn University for 16 years.
Oh, wow.
And so he's moved into that position.
Thank you, Alex. That's what I need to know.
Yeah, I'd just like to see the... when you get the report, what you submitted to the accreditor.
Yes.
I'd just like to review that.
I wrote it. It's a very good report.
Ironclad, huh?
Last
time you were here, there was some a bit of turmoil between dean and students. And how is that going?
How are things going?
Yes.
Well, I must say that the morale at the school is the best it's been for probably almost 2 years. We've had, between some of the minor changes in personnel and minor changes in faculty and students who graduated, the result has been that concerns expressed by the student body have diminished considerably. We have been really working on getting the students to develop their own student body as a means of having their own voice
Do you have a formal student council?
They have developed a formal student council within the last month. Yes. So we have what are called MC meetings, management council meetings, probably about once a week. So now we will have the student body president come in and give reports and ask questions to the management council. They run the school, basically. We are arranging for students and faculty to have also a voice on the board. So the idea, one of the big problems with the school was a lack of communication. The school was running on rumors, and so I think we've really facilitated various avenues to empower the students and to open up avenues so that they can feel like they have a voice and they're heard and they know what we're doing in terms of administration and board. And so I think this has resulted in a calming down of a lot of the concerns. And the morale is, I actually am enjoying going to work now.
Thank you.
I think if I can just maybe add a coda to that, this is Adrian Hall. I think the removal of a former academic dean did a lot to calm the tension and conflict within the administration. And also in terms of making life easier for the students, the clarification and resolution of problems with financial aid, you know, obviously that was very stressful and difficult for them. So I think between those two issues, just me as somebody who is an interested, frequent visitor and observer, I can see a dramatic difference, such as Alex reports.
Ms. Waller, do you have anything you'd like to add before I put my comments in? Mr. Waller, before I add my comments, do you have anything you'd like to add?
No.
Okay. The delay of last month, I think, benefited only your school. I honestly was ready to consider denial. I was so disappointed in the condition of the materials.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to quote a movie, you're not really into that completion thing. There were inadequacies in almost everything. In your business plan, you'd say, and below is, whatever, and wasn't there. Your EA was literally cut and pasted together. A sentence started on one page, and the next page was not a continuation of it. And so I appreciated that you addressed the comments that we forwarded to you to review. I was disappointed that despite giving pretty detail, that obviously we're not here as your consultant, so we can't do a thorough review as if, let's say, I were your consultant and went through to do it. That's not what we're here for. But the major high points. And the EA is still not perfect. And admittedly, I really would have wanted to have seen it perfect. Some of the things on financial aid in your catalog that you fixed, you did fix some of it, and other of it is still lacking. So again, I'm, you know, also share the concern that the level of expertise in your financial aid department is not quite where it needs to be. And obviously, when you go through the Department of Ed, they're going through looking, and they have so many things to review that sometimes they go through the fine-tooth comb and they kick back the things inadequate, and other times, surprisingly, things slip through, and maybe they're caught in a renewal, maybe they're not. But like in your EA, it now looks more professional, which is nice. The pages are lovely numbered, you know, one of nine, etc. However, there's still confusion about the clock and the credit. In the refund policy, you're saying, note, tuition for each quarter is determined by the number of credit hours which students enroll. Oh, really? But on another page, it says you're charging $70 per contact hour. So that is a conflict. Your statement on R2T4, the little blurb that's put in there, is completely incorrect. And I will give it to Ms. Stanfield so that she can give it to you. But again, it ends up being how closely was this read? Did you have anybody with expertise in Title IV review it? If you did, I have to question the level of expertise, because it's just, this paragraph is just flat out wrong. And if students have signed the CA, I strongly suggest that you have them sign a revision, because it's just wrong. On page 6, it has the program dates and it has the fall of 15. So I assume this is just an older one. But I would think, since you're presenting it to us as a new one, that you would have updated that. So that's a lack of doing it by completion thing. The entire agreement, this enrollment consists of 6 pages. It's 9 now. So, you know, not to be like, you know, checking your grammar or something, but those are a big deal, in my opinion. And some of the updates you did to the catalog improved it, but again, not completely following through. It mentioned how Grad Plus was a new program. You took out the new one place, you left in another. You don't cover that the amount of eligibility for the Grad Plus is not as any other aid. So if the student gets outside scholarships or something, that has to be subtracted. You don't say that. The official verification is wrong. It says they must provide a tax return. It's been years since we could take tax returns. You don't have any basic information about student eligibility, like if they're in default or over refunds. They can't get Title IV, and that's pretty basic thing that's not in there. So then I was against Stanfield. So last month, I was saying, let's ask the lawyers just, you know, what exactly we could do to not flat out deny you, and therefore you lose your financial aid. I'm not there this time. I'm happy to prove that you made. But at the same time, I think that whether it's from being overwhelmed from everything that has to be done or a lack of attention to detail, but I'm still not completely confident that without somebody really monitoring things, what the quality is going to be of the administrative stuff. Not your teaching. I mean, I'm assuming that is what you do, and that's what most schools do, is that, you know, you know how to teach the program, but in order to be licensed and be accredited and get federal aid, you have to be able to administer it too. So kudos to the improvement, but not quite good enough. But given that, the original thought had been to request a consent agreement and give very detailed instructions of what else needed to be done. You did accomplish a lot of them. So I'm personally not going to ask for that at this time, but I do believe that we should have continued monitoring, and that a revised enrollment agreement and a corrected catalog need to be submitted, and I'm happy to review them when they come in again. Does any other board member want to make a comment?
Just go back to the accreditation. So what, they come for a visit when?
We haven't chosen a date. It's going to be in the first 2 weeks of October, the first week of November. They'll let us know.
And if those 4 issues are not addressed, what occurs?
They would show no cost. No cost. It's kind of like there's different mechanisms that can be done to keep the school open, but I don't think that the school would be closed. I mean, there are just appeals and all that kind of stuff.
And just in terms of timing, since I think maybe that's partly where your concern is, my understanding is that if the site visit occurs, say, in November, then you'll get a report in February.
Yeah, they'll make the decision in February.
You know, I think I also see, you know, improvements. But honestly, for someone to be it's almost consulting in terms of you have to just know financial aid, you have to know this accreditation, you just have to know that. So we can do is there only an approval at this point for the regular, or can there be some kind of, I'd just like to see before the accreditation occurs, we come back and look at what's been updated with these documents, what's been updated in terms of the accreditation plan.
And also, speaking of the visits, There's been a lot of confusion about the whole two schools thing. And then you gave us a business plan, and it has a lovely picture of your facility. I didn't see the name of the school on it. So unless it's what's the Chinese that you're in there, which frankly I can't read. It says Han University, and it says Han University of Traditional Medicine. And at the top it says Acupuncture School Community Clinic. I don't see the name of this school that we're licensing on there. So is that not the facility that they're in?
That is the facility that they're in.
How does anybody know that? That's a pretty big deal, and I know science is expensive, but I think that you need to have it out there. Say,
so the I would almost like to see what you're looking at because
this is from your
because there's another sign on the school that is the Arizona School of Acupuncture.
So you gave us the business plan for this school, and then you proudly showed us a picture that was completely irrelevant. And so that comes down again to the completion thing. You know, you want us to believe that they are two separate schools, that they're both, you know, entities on their own, and obviously the department asked for some information about that as well. And then you give us a picture that doesn't even show. And then how do we know any of these other pictures? Are they, you know, are they relevant to the school? So, again, it's just a lack of attention to detail. I'm dotting the I's and crossing the T's, and with, you know, I feel like we are. We know you better than almost any other applicant in the history of the 2007 that I've been on this. And that is just worrisome. And I don't want to do anything that would be, you know, giving you a loop into failure, but I also am really concerned that when we grant the license, it would seem that that means that we are saying that you are capable of continuing the school. And I still have reservations about it. Feel better this month than last month. Last month I was really unhappy with you. But we have to make a decision of whether we are going to grant a license, not grant it, or grant it with provisions. And if I
is deferral not an option?
No. We can approve with a consent agreement. And the consent agreement, we would stipulate what it is that we want them to do. And if you don't do them, you don't get another pass. Because it would mean that even after giving you a kind of chance, a bit of a lecture, if you still can't dot your I's across your T's, you know, I just want to question whether you should be, in fact, be still in the business. Mm-hmm.
So the consent agreement, we approve consent agreement. We would specify a number of significant points. They would have to agree with that. And then it would be a specific time frame we would put around that.
And is it appropriate to go so far as to require that the financial aid person participate in some of the Department of Ed's online training to show that is it a woman? That she is getting some of her own base knowledge of financial aid rather than just a person who's been doing it.
He had stepped down, but he had said that she has been taking the online stuff.
Yeah, she did the online training.
Okay.
And she's going to be doing the real life training at some point before the end of the year.
And it would be easy to send it to the FSA conference in December.
No, I mean that's in where lies my trepidation about this whole thing with the Title IV piece and with that, because I brought that up several times over the last year. You know that I'm concerned with that administration that happening. You know, you just point out that it's blatantly wrong. So I guess that's what I'm trying. I don't want to hurt the school. I really enjoy these guys, and I want them to get healthy. It's just. But the same thing, we're trying to protect. I don't know. I'm really torn on this one.
Well, at this point, a lot of the things we ask them to change, obviously, they have changing, but having these not, you know, the EA be wrong, I think was a really big thing for me, that the legal agreement, and I think that was just substantially was incorrect. So we could ask for a consent agreement where they ask us to give back a correct enrollment agreement, update the information in the catalog, and then continue to provide us with the information from the crediting. Are there any other items that...
How could we ask them to demonstrate knowledge of financial aid? I don't know how to ask that. But
proof
of financial aid training.
Madam Chair, can I just, I just want to distinguish. If you just want to stipulate to have them submit more documents, like a corrected enrollment agreement or catalog prior to the granting of the license, you wouldn't need a consent agreement. A consent agreement would be more to put them on like a probationary terms to continue some sort of monitoring or continuation of submission of documents. You have several types of licenses. You have licenses that are reserved for brand new schools where you can put them on types of probation, but those are reserved for brand new schools. A consent agreement would allow you to do that to a school that is not brand new, and that's why I proposed a consent agreement to kind of like a workaround. It would be just a contractual agreement between an existing school and the board to keep them on type monitoring. That would make the board happier with the decision to grant them a license. So if it's just to have them, you know, make a few corrections, you could probably just have them stipulate to submit those prior to the granting of the license or the renewal. But that would be up to you.
If this was the first time, a second time, a third time, I would think it would be just submitting back the corrective material to me. But it's almost like consent. Let's give a very clear time frame. This is what we want to see, and we want to see that represents that they now have the administrative capacity and the knowledge to run this program.
We can work on it.
I mean, that's...
In a consent agreement?
We could.
Because really, I would prefer to go on probation, but that's not an option. So
it's an option. It would be consent to a probation. That's what it would be.
And with
because
that,
you can't order a probation at this phase.
You could consent for probation to issue the license on probation to do these terms and appear before the board at this particular point in time.
And with the time frame with crediting, when we want to give them the opportunity to get that stuff done, though the EA is a critical thing that needs to be done properly.
Can you, without putting them on probation, can you regular degree granting license consent agreement to correct these items and to present fully requisition? I mean, fully do that within 3 months.
Do you want these things done prior to the renewal of the license, or would you want to grant them the license and give them a period of time to do that? And what would the repercussion be should they not complete that? Would you be revoking the license if they don't complete that within 6 months?
Because your license is expired.
Those are the differences.
Yes.
If this is something that needs to be completed prior to the granting of the license, then it would just be a stipulation. But if it's something that you would be giving them X amount of months or even a year to complete prior to the next renewal, there would have to be some sort of a repercussion attached to if they don't complete whatever task you're assigning them. And just so the board members know.
I have a question, if I could.
Yes,
I'm concerned if we put them on probation, mandate that they take certain steps in order to remove that probation. That might, the fact that they were put on probation by the state licensing board might affect their accreditation review that they're undergoing now.
It's essentially
is that a valid concern or?
It is a valid concern.
Yeah, very valid.
It's a disciplinary action that would be reportable on your website.
Can the consent be less than probation and it's not a disciplinary? I think that's what I'm looking for.
We can do a non-disciplinary consent. That's why I was asking, is this something that you would like completed prior to the granting of the license? In which case you wouldn't need the consent, you would just need to stipulate in your motion. Mm-hmm. However, is this something that you would like to attach repercussions to and give them more time to complete?
Their license expired March 31st.
So when will they next be up for renewal?
When
are
we
getting
our license?
Be November 4th. No. No, it's the February 1st. And then February next year.
Is there a way to have their renewal packet be reviewed by everybody?
Which is, this is what, this it was a renewal packet. This was this last reporting period's renewal. So, it could, the next renewal, we could refer to the board as well.
Yeah, that's not it.
Yeah, no, I've automatically referred to renewals. Staff has not done them because of the issues with ACOM. Staff does not do it internal. Staff doesn't do it. It comes before you.
So they have to reapply in 7 months, essentially.
Basically, yeah, just because it expired.
Yep.
It expired in March, which meant we had to have it in February 1st. So, and then it would have, it was originally scheduled for you in April, but it got kicked to May.
So as long as at the next renewal that it would come before the board again, and with everything else they had going on, I fear they would make it more difficult for them if we put a consent on. If we make the stipulation that they have to fix EA, and the things in the catalog are more poorly done, whereas EA is just flat out wrong. I guess I would be okay with doing it with the stipulation, knowing that we will be looking at it again in about 7 months or so. What do you folks think?
So if I'm understanding correctly, we would say we would grant the license with the stipulation, the renewal license, with the stipulation that the following items needed to be corrected before the renewal took effect. And if that hasn't happened by our September board meeting, Ms. Stanfill would bring it to our attention, and we could take action at that point.
It would be the August.
I think what I'm hearing.
August board meeting.
I think what I'm hearing from you is a renewal of the license, with the stipulation that the license not be issued until a revised and updated enrollment agreement and catalog has been received and reviewed by, specified yourself. Once those are okay, the license could be issued. And if not, back at the August meeting.
Does that work? Okay, who wants to make that lovely motion?
I'll make that motion.
Go for it.
Second.
Okay. Now we have a motion and a second. All of the favors say aye.
Aye. Oh, wait a minute. Do we have Ethan to agree to the stipulation first?
Yes.
Yes. Your stipulation. Thank you. Okay. Any nays? Okay. Then the motion is passed. Please don't disappoint us.
Appreciate your words. Thank you. And your actions.
Next item before the board is Biden University. Ms. Campbell, would you give us the summary?
Yes, Madam Chair. Biden University is seeking a graduate degree granting license to operate in the Administrative and Student Support Services Center in Arizona. No other educational activities will be offered. It's a question regarding if they were approved if they're a SARA institution. No, they are not, but primarily, my guess is because California does not yet have legislation to be an NCSARA state, and so therefore they are not. Here representing the institution is Eric. I am not going to try your name.
Right. Awesome.
Sorry.
Right. Walter. Yeah.
And Wally Kakush.
Wally, how are you?
Good, how are you?
And let's see, did I have a board member lead?
Thanks.
Your board member lead is Dr. Rock.
How are you?
Good, good morning.
Maybe just a little opening statement.
Absolutely. Trident University is a 100% online, regionally accredited university in Southern California. We're regionally accredited by WASC. We offer bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees. We are currently seeking state authorization to operate admissions in the state of Arizona.
So essentially, as I mean, I read this, it's really service center, not teaching.
Correct.
Right? Just
correct.
To confirm. And, you know, as I looked at it, I mean, there's I really didn't have anything. I mean, their documentation is good. It's clear. How many employees are you going to have? What are you planning?
We're going to start out with 5 employees.
Okay.
And who will you be working with here in Mesa?
So it's my call center. It's the Hive.
Okay.
So we'll be operating from Mesa Center.
Is it going to be either dedicated employees for the school, or is it just part of a general call center they do multiple?
They will be dedicated employees specifically for Trident.
Because, yeah, there's a lot of training about the things they're allowed to say and not say.
Oh, yeah. We've lived the world for many, many years.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm happy to say we're in good standing with the California Bureau of Credit for Secondary Education, Department of Ed, WASC.
I had nothing else. It's a good package.
It's a good package.
What am I
going to do? Tell Danielle she did a very good job.
Well, thank you. There's a lot of content. I've had a pretty poor way.
We had a lot of conversation.
I, of course, have questions. It's a refinement.
Absolutely.
I print out individual pages. We may have tried to figure out where I was. But on page 6 of 20, 3.3 federal student aid.
Maybe I'll let you ask the question and then I'll see if I can.
Okay. It says that you're certified by the U.S. Department of Education as a participant in certain financial aid. I assume that means you're just approved for federal
yes.
Funding. Unusual use of a word. You're trying to tell the four. This is just a suggestion because we get students get confused with Title IV, so confusing to begin with, unfortunately. It would be good if you just add a little statement saying that the return to Title IV is a policy that is completely separate from the institutional refund policy.
Okay.
Students get confused understanding it, and it's really as applicant manages. The institutional refund policy says how much tuition they're obligated for, and the return to Title IV is how much Title IV they get to keep, and they really don't line up. So I'd just like to see a statement telling you that. And then we're really always worried about puffery because that's the stuff that students come in and complain about it. So I would just like to ask you, can you prove that you're one of the world's most respected and successful online universities?
That's an excellent question. And our attorney would be right there with you. I think our metrics are pretty strong as it relates to how we operate, but to your point, we probably couldn't substantiate that in a clear way, so we probably should refrain from that kind of puffery.
Because again, I'm on a complaint committee and I don't want to see you.
Nothing with all due respect, neither do I.
Okay, anyone else have any questions?
No.
Okay. Would someone like to make a motion?
Sure, if I can find the exact wording. Recommend. Is it a regular degree granting program license? Even though it's just a call center, you still
yeah, we don't
it's
have
still
a specific that's,
okay.
That's,
no. I recommend a regular degree granting program license that they be approved for that.
Maintain the bond, I don't.
No bond.
Oh. I saw it in their packet.
Hey, we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed? The motion passed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I like that name, the aye. The next item for the board is commercial divers.
No, Colette, isn't it?
No. Oh, Colette?
Colette.
Okay. I missed that one,
sorry. I mean, I'll
go. Oh, no, and it's mine, too.
Yeah.
Get yourself that done yesterday. Colette Academy. Is someone here from it or on the phone?
Yes, she's on the phone.
Ms. Santos, would you like to do something?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Colette Academy is seeking a non-accredited vocational program license to offer a program in permanent makeup. Ms. Colette does own a similar business in Pittsburgh, which is currently for sale. And just so you know, Ms. Colette is board certified by the American Academy of Micropigmentation. And Tracy Colette is on the phone. She was here last month, but... So I told her phone would probably be sufficient. And Ms. Leonard, you are the lead.
I am the lead. Ms. Cleft, can you confirm that you're on the phone?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Did you enjoy your trip last month?
It was a quick one.
Well, be thankful you're not here. It is ungodly hot.
Well, I'm actually scheduled to come there tomorrow. So. I was going to come for the 23rd, so I'll be there anyway.
Bring water. Your packet was very nice, thank you. It's very well organized. I have just a couple of questions. The first sure. is, you have confirmed that you are actually going to be here in Arizona running the business?
I am, yes.
Okay. You mentioned that your educators have a minimum of 5 years' experience. And the classes have a maximum ratio of 1-4. I just want to make sure that you know that if you publish that, you can't make exceptions. So you can't decide that you're going to hire someone with 4 years or you're going to put a fifth person in the class. So if you don't want to have it be hard and fast, you could put in generally have a minimum, generally have a ratio of 1-4. And it's up to you. If you feel that you can stick to that, go for it. If not, you'll be before the complaint committee with that fifth student coming in and saying, I was guaranteed 1-4 and I'm the fifth student. Or my teacher has only 4 years and 11 month experience. And we love our schools. We don't want to see them.
I thought I made a correction about that. It was going to be small class sizes. I think there is two places that I forgot to take it out in my book there. But I do want to renew that. And I do, though, plan on having small class sizes, no more than 4 per teacher unless I have an assistant. And the assistant does not have to have 5 years. They're just there to assist me in organizing.
Okay, and that's great, but make sure that where you're advertising it or where it's in your catalog or anywhere else, you specify that or we will get complaints. So it's perfectly fine. There's no legal requirement to have 1-4. But if you generally have 1-4, then you can say that, and then you can say that exceptions when there's an assistant, however you want to do it, but just make sure that whatever you're saying is what you have to do.
To make it very clear. Okay.
Okay. And in Section 3, you have an entrance stipulation that says students must be deemed suitable.
I changed that and resubmitted that. I took that out of there.
Okay.
Let me find it here. What was that under?
Section 3.
I have sorority bonds under Section 3.
She did change that.
Well, it was in your interest, Graham.
I took that out.
Okay. Because obviously you're welcome to have interest requirements. It's just that, you know, deemed suitable just seems like people would say you were prejudiced against them for some reason or other.
Yeah, I understand, yeah.
Okay, Section 10, really is 10, the enrollment agreement. I just want to make sure that your plan is to stick with payments made 30 days in advance. Do you have any exceptions?
Yes. I would make exceptions if I had a late student or something, or somebody was communicating with me properly about, you know, they definitely planned on taking the course. And the reason that I have that is because we have to know ahead of time so that we can schedule models for these students to work on. Not only that, but we are not a supplier. So we also have to gather materials, and they have to be shipped in for their kits, for them to have a practice machine and materials to work with during class. So I do need to know for sure, and I believe that the only way to know for sure is if somebody has submitted all the funds. Because I've had people in Pittsburgh when I've taught classes that have backed out at the last minute when I gave them a two-week window. And it left us stuck because then we had extra models. We had ordered supplies that weren't paid for and so forth. So because there's so much organization necessary to have a class, we ask that they do 30 days in advance.
Great. It's fine to do it, again, because I'm worried about students complaining. If you say that, mm-hmm. and then you let one student make different arrangements, and mm-hmm. there's nothing that says they can, you're going to have people complaining. So it's perfectly fine to leave it. If there are exceptions, you can make the exception be very strong, saying in very unusual circumstances, only as approved by, you know, the director or something like that. Or stick with it. Up to you. Just be consistent. Whatever you say you're going to do, you have to do.
Okay.
And then in numerous places, you talk about utilizing certified mail. And just, again, make sure if you're expressly saying you're doing certified mail, you need to do it. You need to keep proof that you did it that way. Or, again, we'll have students coming in saying, I was put on probation. I never got any mail that said it. And we would say, well, it said you sent certified. Where's your proof that you did? So it's perfectly fine to require that as long as you make sure you stick with it. You can't take a shortcut.
Okay.
There's a brochure where you say your academy is world-renowned. And I guess I was wondering how...
I actually took that out.
Okay,
because the academy isn't world-renowned. I know that in my profession as an artist, I know that people have heard of me around the world only because I've had students from Bulgaria and London and places like that who know of my work. So I probably should not have put the academy, but just speaking for myself. So what I did was I had that brochure removed, and I'm going to reprint it without that in there.
Okay. If you yourself are world-renowned and you can prove it, you're welcome to say that you are, but the academy is not even in operation yet, so certainly it's not world-renowned. I hope for you that it becomes so, but at this time, it certainly isn't.
Yeah. I understand.
And also, the finest school around, same thing. I hope that that's true, but you can't say that.
I took that out, too.
Okay. And then also in the brochure, it said that the ratio of students to faculty was 1-2. And other materials said 1-4.
I took that out, too.
Okay, good.
I actually removed the whole brochure. All of those things, I haven't even reordered it yet, but I will be reordering the brochure minus all of those things.
Okay, well, I will be asking for a stipulation that when you do redo the brochure, that you send it in to staff for review.
Yes, I will.
Okay, good. Anyone else have any questions, concerns, or comments?
You just need to be careful on being specific on some of the things you're saying, such as after hours. You can connect with us after hours for phone assistance. And you need to, you know, really be careful on how well you define things, and so you don't paint yourself in a corner. And we have students coming here saying, you know, I can call at any time, and I'm not getting anybody on the phone and things like that.
Yeah, any time for some people is 1 a.m.
So, you know, just...
Pardon me?
Yeah, really.
Any time after hours for some people may be 1 a.m.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, with the time change and people all over the world, I can imagine it would be. So.
Okay. If there aren't any other comments, then I will make a motion to grant the conditional vocational program license with the stipulation that the bond of $15,000 be maintained, and that the advertising brochure be sent in to staff. Second?
Second.
Do you agree to those stipulations?
Yes.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion passes. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Now, commercial Bible.
There we go.
All right. Ms. Denton, would you like to give us a brief summary?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the board. Commercial Divers International is seeking a non-accredited vocational program license to offer a commercial diver program. They do have the $15,000 surety bond. Mr. Phillips also owns Richard Phillips Marine, and representing the institution is Richard Phillips and Dwayne Murray, and your board member lead is Mr. Thurr.
Hi. Good morning and welcome back. Thanks. Sorry about last time.
Yeah.
Lucky you're local, though. So,
yeah.
Could you introduce yourselves for the record, all three of you, please?
I'm Dwayne Murray, Vice President.
I'm Richard Phillips, President.
Virginia Phillips, Chairman of the Board.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Would you like to make a brief statement about your school, or your planned school? Anything?
Well, first, good morning, board members.
Sort of. Five more minutes. That's 6 minutes.
Basically, just a quick thing. You know, I've been in the industry for 25 years. I've heard a lot of stuff just sitting in the back row listening. You know, I heard a lot.
That's our hope.
We kind of fit some of the things where, you know, there's people who know the industry are going to teach the industry. Those same people that know our industry aren't going to administrate our industry. We're going to work collectively together because I don't know too many deep-sea divers that are financial aid experts and things like that. I don't think it exists, actually. Again, I've owned my own business for 17 years. Done probably close to $100 million worth of business. Most of the work we do is government work, both federal level, state level, municipality levels, licensed in 7 states. I've worked all over the world. Excited about this industry. There's only a few schools in this industry. The biggest thing, as an employer, I've found that it's hard to get good help a lot of times. It's been something I've been thinking about for many years. My wife will tell you probably 10 years plus. But, you know, just kind of fell in the right time at the right place in life, and something I've been passionate about. I'm very passionate about my career, and I'm looking forward to this.
Good. Who put together your application? You did a really good job. Thank you. And these people can tell me I kind of get a little bit cantankerous when I get bad applications put together.
I appreciate that.
And this one was done very well, so for that I thank you. You know, that being said, I just have a few questions. First of all, I commend you on the school. I think it's a cool idea, not one you generally think about in Arizona, you know, because we're landlocked. I mean, I grew up in the Northwest, so I knew the diving school up there up in Seattle for a lot of years, you know, was pretty known. But also being a Navy veteran, you know, I thought this was cool, you know, so I liked it. And it makes sense to me. The application made sense to me, so I was happy for that. But I do have a couple questions. Of course, you knew that. Nothing too heavyweight, but I'll kind of get through that. Mr. Phillips, you had said in tab 7 that any losses incurred by the international will be by Divers International will be funded by you, your other company, correct? So
yes,
and it says for 2 years, but reality in this business, especially because this is a pretty big cash outlay, for students without Title IV funding. 2 years is a pretty quick time to get profitable. So I guess I just want some reassurance that if it goes beyond that 2 years, that you're able to liquid enough to take care of that.
Yeah, I don't plan on. I plan on keeping my parent, Richard Phillips Marine, fully business, and I've got several employees and things like that. So it's going to take what it's going to take.
Yeah.
Take this thing to where it supports itself.
Yeah, it's more just a caution. Just like you said, you guys come from the diving world, and I think this is good. But I just want to make sure that every time you're bringing in school people too that know how to run schools and administer schools, because it's a whole different world. Just like I wouldn't profess to know how to deep sea dive, and just do it. So do that. This appears a few places without throughout. So I'm looking at tab 10, but the education requirements for your students. First of all, it says you have to be 18. That's firm for you? They have to? Is that insurance purposes?
I believe so. Yeah. Is that how we came up with that?
Okay, just know that somebody, 17 that shows up, which happens all the time in our type of schools, that you're, by your own admissions, you're not going to even consider them. Okay, so.
And just real quick on that, sometimes schools will allow a student to start when they're younger, but they have to be like 18 to graduate. So make sure if you're saying you have to be admitted at 18, you really can't even start until they're 18. And so if there isn't a hard and fast rule for insurance or whatever that they have to be 18, just make sure that you're not making exceptions if you're saying it. And we don't know what the rules are. If there is a rule that says they have to be 18, the question is stupid either. But we so see this slippage. People start out and they want to be really firm. And then someone comes, or they're still mature, and
absolutely,
their dad, and whatever. And so if you say it, you have to do it. So you
can't
admit anyone under 18.
I think the chairwoman's correct, and I think if you probably picked up today, if it's in this, a catalog's and it's also in your catalog. Catalog's a legal binding document, and there are stuff that absolutely has to be in the catalog, and we look for each of those check marks and you cross reference for it. There's stuff that doesn't have to be, but sometimes I think schools want to be super firm or stuff, and then they back themselves in their corner. So that's why we mention it, okay? Because we're not telling you have to back yourself into that corner. If you have some industry standard, which does, then we're fine with that. Below that, again, appears several places, but it says, students are required to provide documentation providing graduation from a qualified high school or GED program in addition to the high school diploma or GED. They must be proficient in written and oral language skills and mechanical skills. What mechanism are you assessing that by?
Well, I would say the biggest thing would be in the industry, there's the heaviest emphasis is on math. For record-keeping purposes of dive times and things like that. So I guess what we're trying to say there is that we want to make sure that someone understands, a potential student understands the heavy math involved for, the industry that's involved. That was kind of the meaning.
Yeah, well, I think, Mr. Phillips, your meaning is fine, but let me give you some advice here for a free nickel advice here. There's lots of... A standard one is the Wonderlic SLE. There's a lot of exams you can give that at least give you that are standardized or whatever that will entrance exams will give you at least a level of which to gauge that. You figure if they can get through that, they must speak English well enough or their mathematics. There's all different things. I'm not certainly prescribing one you do, but if you're going to say that, there's got to be an assessment measure of how you assess it by. Because again. I chair the complaint committee, and me and Ms. Leonard don't want to see you back there with a student who said, I told them I could, because really down here in the Southwest, as you guys know, English as a second language is very real and alive, and such like that. So I would identify what that would be for you, okay?
Yes, sir.
Tab 9, I'm looking at your grievance procedure, my only question there is on bullet point one, grievance procedure steps, again, tab 9. It says a student submits a grievance by writing a formal letter detailing the issue. Okay. that's after they've kind of talked to the people at the school, I see right there. But are you going to time frame that? I mean, can how long do they have to do that? You don't have to. I'm just wondering, you know, and such like that, you know, of X amount of days. You timeline yourself, which I appreciate, you know, tell them how long you have to do. But I just want, it's just a mention, you decide, but if you want somebody...
Are you referencing the timeline for the student to...
Submit. Yeah. I mean, do you really want somebody to start it and then all of a sudden, you know, 12, 13 months down the road goes all back a month from now that, you know...
We should.
Not that that's ever going to really stop them, but you should probably, you know, guide them on that right. A little bit. That's all I would recommend there. Okay. Everything else there looked good. Your catalog looked really good. Again, in your catalog, that's just the one thing I said about assessing. I looked at your advertising, and I was very glad to see there wasn't a lot of puffery there or anything like that. The only thing I would point out, it's on this document, is that you quote salaries. You can make the average starting wage for a commercial diver is $54,000 per year. The top percent, 90%, make $84,000. One, again, sitting on the complaint committee, guess what students are going to, which number there they're going to say they were promised to get. Number two, if you're ever quoting salaries, you need to put the source of what source that was and where you did that. And again, my last friendly advice is don't quote salaries on the thing. That creates nothing but problems for you. Certainly tell students to go check salary.com, the BLS, those type of things on their own. But the minute you start quoting salaries as a student, they're going to hold you accountable for that. And it's always the bigger number, not the smaller number. They're going to say, well, look at it. I'm only making $30,000. I just graduated, and they said I'd make $84,000, you know, and now I want my money back, you know, or some offset. So I would strike that if I was you. If you are going to leave it there, I insist that you cite this by where it came from and who did that, okay?
Cite source. On that same note,
a lot of people do BLS.gov or whatever. They'll pull it off of that. No, they'll cite them. They'll cite that.
Most of our work is, you know, prevailing wage works, things like that, and states and things like that. That's advertised on the website with, you know, like California's $109 an hour, 8-hour minimum.
Yeah.
So you don't recommend putting that in any type of marketing.
I think it's risky. I don't think you can, you know, talk about it, but I would tell you I've never run a dive school, but I've run many schools over the last 20 some years, and any time you quote salaries or people in your staff are quoting salaries, they get it. So, for instance, I used to have a rep who, and he used to go talk to surgical tech students that were coming in, and he's like, yeah, you know, you're going to probably start off about $30,000-$40,000, but I know I have some friends that are working in cardiovascular. They make almost $100,000 a year. And so what number did they remember? What did they always end up in my office complaining about? Was the $100,000, you know? And so it's just risky business. There's no need to do it. There's plenty of non-biased neutral sites you can send. You can talk about what a good living it is. It is. I don't think there's a lot to... I mean, I think that's known, even as a non-diver. I know that divers get paid, you know, pretty good money, you know, so, as they should. It's dangerous work, you know. So that would be my advice. I know the temptation is there because you want to pull people in, you know, and that's it. But, again, I'm trying to save you a headache down the line. And if you are going to quote salary, which I can't stop you from doing, cite it. Just cite where your source was, okay? Because then it's not you saying it, you know, right. Phyllis, it's the site said it and such like that. So that's my advice. But if you do keep it or you are listing at places, cite it, okay?
Yes, sir.
Now, can you go over what your financial plan is? I mean, how for people pay for this? I can't quite remember. Do you have banks you're working with? Or,
well, we have, you know, obviously with being non-accredited is, you know, is a challenge to overcome.
Are you planning on doing accreditation after 2 years? After two years, yeah, good.
So all of our, you know, all of our competitors, let's say there's six of them, they're all accredited. Most of them, I don't think any of them's ever dissolved or anything. You know, they've been passed down
generations,
basically how this industry rolls out. But that being said, we have a few options. We have in-house financing options that we're going to self-finance. We're going to, we're looking at some larger of the recourse and non-recourse avenues right now that we could help maybe our students, mm-hmm. although it, you know, they seem to be high on interest rates. I don't know how that really helps students, you know, per se. So it is challenging, but that's, and Dwayne, you can, you know, that was what the area you're working on, but the way I understand it is mostly in-house financing and recourse and non-recourse right now. And we do have some relationships, you know, my Richard Phillips Marine has a great relationship with some larger banks, mm-hmm. but, you know, they have that big accreditation out there and says, if you're not accredited, you know, it's hard to get money for the trade school.
Yeah, I mean, the road you're embarking on is going to be difficult for 2 years, and I want, that's why I asked my first question out of the gate was where your liquidity was, should you not, you know, in 2 years be where you want to be financial, because I don't know that we've ever seen anybody be where they say they're going to be financially on these applications.
It's almost like if you're in the restaurant business and you say, hey, I want to open up a restaurant, and you're granted a restaurant license, but then they say for the first 2 years you can't open up Friday and Saturday nights.
Right.
You know, that's when everyone goes out to eat dinner.
Yeah, you get it.
So I get it. I understand why the way they are.
And I think, again, I think this is a good, viable school. I think you're going to have some initial marketing challenges like Arizona Diving, do that. But I think if you guys work it right, maybe liaison with some of the high school and the current technical lab, and you'd be on there. Advisor boards, so you're going to do just fine. I just think this first 2 years will be tough, so keep your nose to the grindstone. We'll liaison with people that know the school business you do if you run into that. And certainly when you get into Title IV and those applications, you really have to bring somebody in to do that.
Most of our instructors are ex-Navy chiefs.
Yeah, I see that. I read that. Again, a wonderfully done application. I'm just very happy with it. So with that, I'm no more questions. I'll kick it to my fellow board.
If you're doing your org chart, who is actually in charge of admissions? There's a director of education oversees enrollment, but will you have an admissions advisor on staff?
Yes.
You will? Okay. You just didn't put that on your own.
Yeah, we're just, you know, we'll make sure we put that.
You should add that. He's right. That was the note I had earlier. Yeah. That's, I mean, no department's more important or less important, but if you don't have a good admissions effort, you're never going to have a school. That's the reality.
Any other questions?
Not for me.
I have a couple.
Of course you do. Okay. So I saved those for you.
Thanks. In your catalog, you have the cancellation and refund policy on page 17 of 34. And it continues on to 18.
What page?
F7.
In the catalog, page 17 of 34.
I'm sorry, you said page 17?
Page 17 and 34.
15.
Okay.
Now we're going somewhere else.
So, and it continues on to page 18.
Yes.
And then inexplicably, it starts all over again.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
And it's on page 19.
Oh, that's a good thing.
I was trying to compare them to see if you had something different there, but it's not going to be. So go ahead and take out the duplicate. On page 21, the leave of absence request is oddly worded, and part of it is, my background is Title IV, and they have very specific leave of absence rules. And if you are going to become accredited and keep on moving, you might want to use things that are more industry standard. So you have, if the student doesn't return on a scheduled return date and up to 14 days from the approved request, I don't understand what that means. Are you trying to say it's a 14-day leave absence maximum?
Yes.
Okay, that's not what you're saying. It's confusing. So if you would just change that to say leave of absence is limited to 14 days, and then it would make sense. And then the attendance policy. Students may have no more than 10 absences over the entire length of the program. Any student who approaches 8 will be notified in writing. So approaches 8. So... And they have 7 absences.
So we need to be more specific.
Yeah.
7.5.
Right. 7.34.
5.
Trade me from
Otis. Reaches eight, would that be appropriate?
Yeah, student who has eight absences will be notified in writing. Whatever it is, or is it seven? You want to notify them at seven? Like, whatever your rule is, just say it, because I just don't know what it means.
Right.
I mean, you should have a process in place where you're monitoring this to that the student's not halfway done with the course, and they've got four absences already. That should be a red flag where you start talking to that student already. So.
Yeah.
And it says that a warning, you can notify the student and it's going to be placed in their file, so you're telling them and you're documenting it, and a student reaches 10 absences will be academically dismissed. And that's a definitive statement. So that means that you may not allow a student to continue who has, once they have 10 absences. And if that's what you mean, that's fine. But if some of them come and whine, and you're going to say, okay, well, I'm going to let you make it up, you need to have a whining clause, because if you say this and then you let Johnny do it and you didn't let Susie, they're going to be before the complaint committee, and we are highly motivated to not have you front the complaint committee. So,
well,
have you picked up on that?
Right. I mean, the majority of the complaints that come before us are that the policy wasn't followed or that they weren't notified per the policy correctly. So.
Yeah. And we had one at a recent meeting where he basically said that he admitted that he did not meet the attendance policy, but he knew other people who didn't meet it were allowed to continue. And he sent us volumes like this to justify why, even though he knew we broke the rule, it should have been, he should have been allowed to do it because other people allowed to do it. And it was a complete impossible waste of time, so don't waste your time.
Got it.
Just, you know, if 10's really important to you, fine, kick them out, I don't care, then, but just stick with it. And then the Director of Student Services is available to assist students who may have attendance issues. That's really vague. Like, what's may? Is it going to be the student? Are you letting the student know that if they're having issues, come speak to that person? Are you saying that person is not responsible for contacting the students? So it's just sort of vague. Or even just say, the Director of Student Services is available to assist students who have attendance issues. And then you're saying, I'm here if you need me.
Sure.
But this just may, it's like, are you going to decide to go on to? And the student will be determined to be withdrawn if the student has not attended any class 30 consecutive days, class days. But you weren't come out at 10. So.
That's true.
I'm not sure what 30 means.
Based on leave of absence, maybe?
I don't know.
Official leave of absence.
Do you mean, yeah, I don't know what you mean. How many days a week do they go to school?
Five.
Yeah, so after 2 weeks, they've already hit 10, so what does the 30 days mean?
Where exactly what page are you?
It's on page 21. Mm-hmm. The attendance policy, it's a two-paragraph thing.
Right there. Yeah.
There's a lot of things that will come for the complaint committee in those two paragraphs.
Yeah, I see.
Okay, and then I apologize. I do not know where I got this other than it's page 11. And it says requirements for graduates to practice.
Okay.
I don't know where I got it.
That would be part of the program.
That's program for study form, I bet you.
Yeah, piece, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we at here?
So 10.
Okay, yes.
So this isn't a requirement to graduate. This is just
to practice in the industry.
Help them understand how to practice, okay. So it says that the card is provided after the graduate has met or exceeds the minimum 625-hour training requirement. So does that mean that you, and this is my ignorance of your industry, are you giving them that card?
We basically proctor to the Association of Diving Contractors International, which is our kind of our industry governing body, so that employers know that, you know, this is where an entry-level card, someone could get hired to go work offshore in the Gulf of Mexico or work for a a mom-and-pop type company, Inland or something like that. So that's really our governing body to get, you know, for the employer to know that this person's been trained properly.
So is it a test they're taking, or is it literally clocking 625 hours?
It's both. According to ANSI standards, which is what the commercial diving industry falls under, and OSHA requires ANSI standards to be met in order to grant an entry-level diver tender card. There's tests involved, and there's practical, and there's time involved that you have to meet milestones.
We've had instances where schools have said that they certify the students for something, and really the certifying is by a different board, or they just made it up to make stuff up fancy or something. I'm not sure where this falls in there.
That's honestly what's going to get them employed.
So perhaps you make it a little bit more definitive as to what that card, where it's coming from, and how you get it.
Yeah, because it says it's from the Association of Diving Contractors, mm-hmm. but it says it's provided after the graduate has met or exceeded. So I was left not really understanding. Is it an auto give? Is something I apply to?
So I remember that I would have to proxy that person.
Yeah, the school is proctoring. The school is what the way the ADCI has. They have a form and you fill out the number of students that graduated or is intending to graduate. And then they issue those cards to the school, and then in our graduation ceremony, we hand that card to them at the ceremony. But it's on behalf of the Association of Diving Contractors.
So is this something that's published, or did you just give this to us?
No, that would be published in the consensus standards for the ADCI.
Okay. In my opinion, it would behoove you to have this make sense to somebody who doesn't know as much as you. So the person coming in, if I decide I want to do it, which I wouldn't because I can't do the whole breathing underwater thing, but that I would know what it meant. I just don't know what it means.
Yeah, you almost got to be in the industry to understand that, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right, and this is for somebody you want to bring into the industry. Yeah. No, that's from the industry.
Because if they say, well, I graduated, I didn't get one of these cards, and they told me it was going to be given to me because they just provided it. That just sounds like freebie.
Right.
Good catch.
Yeah.
Thank you for the helpful talks here.
We haven't really so much from the complaint committee.
Well, being a newbie here, it sounds like the general theme here is you got to be consistent from one person to the 24th person, to the 240th person. So.
Yeah. And it's explicit.
Yeah.
We're consumer protection, so you know, we can't say if you do a good job teaching it. But if we start having students coming in saying, I finished the school and I couldn't get a job, or I got a job and only paid $89,000, I was expecting $103,000, those kind of complaints that we get. And we get a lot of unfounded complaints. We get a lot of just misunderstanding. But these things we're pointing out to you would be valid. A student has the right to complain, and you don't want to give them that. In this draft, as an adventure awaits, which is very catchy. In addition to learning the skills to become a world-class commercial diver, CDI also provides you training on preparing your resume, how to effectively interview, and will refer you to potential employees after graduation. That's, you're saying you will. So that means every single student, you have to refer them to employers. And it can't just be, this is a place that we know hires.
Right.
It would be that you're working in partnerships. It's almost like a placement thing. So if you don't do that, just be careful about the wording, because I would take this out reading it saying, you're gonna give me some, you're gonna set up interviews for me.
No, as small as this industry is, our mission is all these other diving contractors, my competitors, a lot of them. My goal ultimately is to earn their phone call first. They call our school for our graduates, right. And we're gonna have constant communication, finding out how this student did, where was their weaknesses, where was their strengths, so that I can put better people to work for these employers to help them.
Okay, because you say you will. This means kind of like we have schools that have externships, and which is one of the highest complaint areas that we have. Mm-hmm. So when they come in here and they say, well, we're planning on doing this, it's like, no, we need to know who you've been talking to, how they agreed to do it. So if you're just saying, I'm dreaming of doing this, it feels so good to be sending these students off to jobs, but you really don't have arrangement with anyone, then you can't be saying will, because if you're saying will, you're saying by the time your first student graduates, you have jobs lined up for them. If you don't think you can do that, then you have to change how you're wording this. If you're going to be able to do that, it's lovely. Go for it. That's all I have.
Okay. It's going to need a little tweaking.
Yeah.
Imagine it was.
Okay.
Lofty idea that perhaps might be hard to accomplish. All right, any other questions? Entertain a motion.
All right, I make a motion that we grant the conditional vocational program a license to the Commercial Diver International Inc. With the following stipulations: that they maintain the $15,000 surety bond, they make the noted catalog changes that were called out, and they make the changes to the marketing material as called out.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Great. We have a motion and a second. Do you agree to the stipulations for the bond?
Do you agree to the stipulation for the surety, to maintain the surety bond and make the changes?
Yes, sir.
Did all those in favor say aye?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Hearing none? Thank you.
Congratulations.
Have fun, because it sounds like it's fun.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, I should be underwater right now.
I wish I was underwater right now.
Next for the board is the Contemporary Dental Academy. Ms. Danfield?
Mr. Chairman, Chair, members of the board, Contemporary Dental Academy is seeking a non-credit vocational program license to offer programs in the dental assistant and front office administrator. Dr. Smallwood also owns a dental practice of which the students will be taught. Here representing the institution is Dr. Fred Smallwood and Colton Harper.
Good afternoon.
Can you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Dr. Trent Smallwood. I'm a practice in Tempe, Arizona.
I am Corey Harper, dental hygienist.
Mr. Harper, is your
name? Hi.
Hi.
How are you? Thanks for bearing with us. It's been kind of a long day. And I think you guys were here at the last meeting as well, weren't you? That
we were.
The non-meeting, so... appreciate that. So you, would you like to make an open statement about your plans,
sure.
Your school?
Basically, we're starting a school to help educate young, usually young individuals to learn how to do dental assisting and dental front office, something that's not really offered for the most part in the industry. Hygienists have to have, of course, sanctioned education as well as doctors. But the other area that's very involved is assisting within dentistry as well as front office. And they just have to really learn by knowing somebody in the industry. And so we thought basically that we would bring in some education to help these young people be able to learn contemporary concepts out there, more innovative type of concepts, much of which I teach doctors almost every weekend myself. And so taking it out to a different level. And we're very excited and motivated to be able to teach these young individuals more in this industry.
Great.
Do they have to be done?
No, they don't have to be done. I should
really
say that. That's good.
They can't go and
change careers. But chances are they're going to be. Okay. I've seen the same verbiage. Did you construct this yourself, or did you buy like the curriculum and some of this, get somebody to help you with this application?
We constructed it ourselves.
Okay. I just see the same thing. It's maybe your opinion, and I don't mind, but there's always that piece in there where it says, you know, that the other schools aren't doing a good job and they're uneducated. I just never understood why they put that in there, because it just seems like it's kind of bad taste, but whatever.
I thought we took that out. We did.
Not mine. Under the business marketing plan. But that's where I want to go, to the business marketing plan.
Okay.
You have 22 students, you say, that you're looking to do the first year. Again, and I think you heard me mention several others, we never see people hit their first numbers, you know, and stuff like that. So how do you plan on acquiring those students? That's a fairly good number.
Well, I think we actually said that the first year would be 11.
Do I have a different application, Ms. Stansfield?
I think maybe what you may be thinking of is, remember, there's two elements to this.
No, it says right here, 22.
Okay, I think it's in reference to 11 being in the business marketing plan, the first page. It deals with 11 in the assisting category, and then 11 within the front office administrator capacity. So
I see what you're saying.
There really are kind of two different animals within the business. And most of you probably have been to the dentist where you see that somebody will clean your teeth, somebody will actually help the doctor do various type of capacities, and then somebody will actually take your money and deal with the financial part.
Yeah, I think we're all, I mean, most of us have dental schools. I have dental hygiene and dental assisting at the school I run.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm familiar with it. So
there, it's not just one type of entity, I guess. It's dentistry, definitely, but it's two kind of forms of that dentistry. So that's where I feel like that number is realistic because of the fact that it hits two different demographics.
Okay, yeah, I'm not saying it's not, but I'm asking how you're going about to advertise and market. How are you going to acquire your students?
Okay, well, first of all, our biggest area that we wish to hit is our primary high schools, because of the fact that, going back to not only young people will, of course, be part of this, but the fact that that is a great place for young students that maybe don't want to go into college. This would be a great type of secondary part of the education for them. And be able to enter into that capacity. So that is where we hope to approach.
Okay, that's good. The one area I always worry about with this, and you have a fairly good sized practice, no?
I do.
Yeah, how many operatories do you have?
Eight.
Eight, okay. Are you the only dentist?
Right.
Yeah. So how many, the clinical hours is what I always worry about.
Okay.
And when I see schools, there's, as you probably in your market research notice, there's a lot of dentist office doing dental assisting education out there. And I just want to make sure you're able to service the clinical part of it. If you have 22 students, are you able to take all those on at your office and do the clinical?
Well, if you, I think the gentleman behind you saw our facility. It's a little different than most offices in the sense that it's roughly 5,000 square feet, where the average office is about 1,400.
Yeah, I noticed it was. I saw the drawings. So
right.
Yeah.
So I basically have the facility to be able to accommodate this now, and that's of course from the educational standpoint. The clinical part of it. Yes, we do have eight operatories, but we don't utilize eight operatories. Mm-hmm. I, at any given time, have two hygienists that may take their own, and then I may use two of my own. So we have four that I primarily use, mm-hmm. but we have the capacity for eight. I'm not going to have all eight at one time, but I also only work myself 3 days a week.
Okay. So. Well, my question for that is that you have to be able to offer the education wholly uninterrupted as stated. So I think it's very much would behoove you to maybe get a clinical agreement with another couple practices in case you aren't able to handle that volume at the time.
Okay.
We call them externship agreements or clinical agreements with somebody else that can have that, because what you can't have is people backed up and waiting to do the clinicals and such like
right.
that should you not do this. And this is as you know, you're taking on a lot more on top of a practice that sounds
right.
fairly successful, so you have to be able to do that. So I would look into some type of clinical agreement, or if you have, I'm sure you have fellow dentists out there that might be willing to do that in a relief type situation.
Okay.
Because you have to give them that 48 clinical hours for the assistants, okay, and then however much it is for the front office to do that.
Mr. Therapy, that helps you. We've spent a lot of time, of course, making sure and agonizing over that number, because we want to make sure that we get as much possible time for them, and we do feel like that is a realistic number that we can't provide.
Good. Good. That's just what I wanted to hear.
I know. I've heard that a few times today. Yes, I do not want to be back here for that.
I need Ms. Stans. I'll skip. She left right at this time. So I'll come back to that question. I need her. Let's see where my next stickies are. Sorry. I reviewed this for the last meeting. Okay, so if a student feels your grievance procedure, so the tab grievance procedure, so that's not looking for a number, but if a student feels the matter is still unresolved, they must submit an appeal to the director within 48 hours of receiving administrative response. The director will respond in writing within 3 working days. The only question I had on there is, what if their grievance is on a Friday and they're, Saturday, Sunday, and you're not really operating on weekends, so maybe that 48 hours would probably more realistic, to be fair to the students, to say two business days. Okay. Yeah. I would change the 48 hours because, again,
with respect to the 1 a.m.
Yeah, you could, again, specific, because they'll hold you to every word. Because like students can't read sometimes until it comes to agreements, and they read everything.
I have to say one nice thing about being towards the end of this is hearing all of the rest of these. That has educated us tremendously.
If you'd like to hang around at 2 o'clock,
no, it's okay. I think I
got a lot. Doctor, we have a complaint committee meeting coming up at 2, so anybody's welcome to stay for that and get educated.
I'm
so
nervous.
And that's the same thing that there was coming up in your enrollment agreement. I had the same type of question in there. Okay. So if you could change that. Yeah, I think it was, I don't know what tab I'm under, the catalog, and a unique hands-on element of the course, which is page, catalog one, I don't have a page number, got cut off on mine.
Like page three.
I guess it is number three, thorough internship to provide real-world experience in a busy dental office with over-the-shoulder direct in treatment, watching over observation and real solidify the foundations. There's also hands-on training with actual patients with an instructor in the room to guide the students. I certainly hope the instructor is in the room to guide the students. It'd be a little scary. Again, here, this just goes back to my having, other than your office, having some agreements in place to provide the internship clinical training. It's a necessary part before we back up.
And why is it unique?
Yeah, and I was...
Well, I think it's unique because of the fact that what I really pride myself on this part of the program is that, from what I'm understanding from really any other program, is that there isn't a hands-on element both in application on what we, just basically dummies or teeth or what we call typodonts or dentiforms, fictitious or realistic, but teeth, not real. And then we apply that towards a real-life setting, an actual use on live patients. Now, remember that front office don't actually get into somebody's mouth. It's just discussion. But a dental assisting is a little different, and hence why the program is about a month longer, is where they have to be able to handle the patient in a clinical setting by making temporaries. Many of you probably have had procedures like this done, or assisting the dentist in placing composites and various types of dental procedures that they do. So that is where it's unique, because I don't know of any other program that actually works specifically on patients themselves. They may work on each other and such, but it's not the same as a real-life environment. That's why I've made that statement.
Did that
take it's puffery. Yeah, I guess just because it says unique, it doesn't say world-class, best in the world, most awesomest.
That's my entire application.
Yeah.
So the student going to come to us and say, he said he was unique, but my cousin went to one in Mesa.
I think this letter point is germane. I'm not going to 100% prescribe. You have to remove that, but I would think about removing that. Okay.
You are a unique individual, but perhaps.
I see. Okay.
I think it's
she sees this every day, so she knows. But maybe for
that reason. Okay, moving on. I want to go backwards for a sec to the insurance cert now that Ms. Stanfield came back in the room. So, it was right when she walked out. So, proof of liability. Do you have an update on one of these, Terry? Because I do not see you guys are as a writer on this.
Oh, yeah.
See the certificate holders, Frank, Dr. Smallwood, but.
I'm sorry. What?
Yeah, proof of liability insurance. We require the $1.3 million liability, but we require the Arizona State Board to be a rider on that. So.
Good point. I don't know how that happened.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Usually, it's a certificate.
The holder will need to be
liability. Which this is that, but we are then also named as an additional insured, so that if you don't pay your policy, we get notified.
I see.
Oh, okay. So we have to be added as a certificate holder.
So under additional name insured.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, most of us just have the certificate, and then the certificate holder would be Arizona Private.
Yeah.
Okay. And that point did come up, and we did get that. So
I know it. That's why I'm surprised. This is.
Okay, well, I'm glad you got it, but I didn't see it. So
It's not in this one.
Yeah, when we copied, we just took the one and copied that.
Yeah, okay. We did have one.
Okay, we'll make sure that that.
You know, you did quote salaries in your catalog, moving on, which, but you did cite them, so I'm not going to, again, I don't necessarily like it, but I just, you at least you cited it, so that takes you off, you know. I had a question on your, again, I don't, my catalog numbers got cut off, so it's under the entrance requirements, would be cross-references 6B.
Okay, in catalog?
Catalog,
okay.
Tab.
6B is in void?
Well, no, it's, yeah, it's under entrance requirements, but it's cross-reference to 6B. I don't want to back here. Silly mountain.
And what is the headline, Mr. Chair?
Entrance requirements.
Okay, yes, right.
Got it?
Yep.
Of course, I don't now because my phone's shut. So let me get back to where I was. Hit myself in the face with it too. Back 1,000 today. For, again, I ask you the same question I asked the last school. So you were saying they must be 18. You're not going to entertain anybody that's 17.
And my main reason for that is honestly the capacity of the material. I'm not going to say that a very astute, very bright 14-year-old couldn't do this.
No, I'm not. They have to be past the age.
and that does come in.
But I give my daughter, like, for instance, who graduated when she was just a little over 17, you know, before she went to university. So, yeah, you can do it. I'm not telling you not to. I'm just saying that, but you can't not do it now. You know what I'm saying? You get somebody who came in that said, hey, I graduated, I'm 17 and a half. You can't say, okay, come into my program.
No, we thought about that. And we realized that it's probably going to potentially delay or make ineligible at least 40%.
You thought about it, so that's all that I'm asking. Okay.
He's right. I graduated at 17 as well.
I know.
And you're pretty smart.
Very smart.
Well, you're really smart. I just say that.
Look, now I'm too old, and then I was too young.
Well, and it does, because that is a very, very pointed age, and really we're just deciding whether you're a senior at 17, a senior at 18, and maybe there's even seniors at 19, you know, and so they could qualify as a junior at high school, and that could be an issue, too, because of the fact that they just simply made they're 18. So if that was changed or amended, it would just be something that we would put through you. Okay. So, I mean, we did go around.
You can just change it. I mean, if you want to. Okay.
You could just put 18 years old or high school graduate beyond age of compulsory.
Compulsory, that's the word I was looking for. See, I knew you were smart.
What was it?
Compulsory
beyond the age of compulsory age.
When he said 14, I was trying to say, but they got to be above the age of compulsory education. And it's 16 in this state, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. You can quit high school and go take a GED, but you have to be over
16. Before that, it's against the law for you to drop out of school. Your parents get arrested.
Great.
Okay, so moving on, B on that. I guess, why'd you settle on the Myers-Briggs personality test? I've never seen this before, and I guess my simply question was a big WHY.
Well, of course, there's multiple tests that you could use there, but I've been involved with this test since probably about the last 10 years, and when I've had employees, most of my employees take it, and it just tells me a tremendous amount about what kind of personality I'm dealing with. And if we have them take it before, it doesn't necessarily make me discriminate against anybody. It just necessarily, what it does is help me understand that type of person and how they're thinking and whatnot. And if I classify this with each one of the 11 students that we have, then, or 22, then it could help me just understand what they're thinking and how they think. That's simply what it is.
That's fine. You know, I'm just going to play devil's advocate because I'll see this as devil's advocate. I'm going to come back and say, you know, Dr. Smallwood didn't admit me because of my personality test. So then you're going to have to come in front of us. I'm going to say, show me your non-biased rubrics to how you stack rank this to let them into your program.
Well, maybe
it's going to cause you problems. I'm just telling you. I'm not saying, and if you want to give it, I'm okay, but why, don't put it in the entrance requirement then.
Or put a preference saying Myers-Briggs is not used in the selection criteria.
Yeah, you could put it.
Well, that is true, because it is something we probably would have them, I mean, honestly, take the first day. It's not a requirement to work. I can't accept you because you refuse.
Again, I understand why you want to do that. I think it's a good idea because you want
to. The placement, I like the intention. The placement's probably not the best because I really don't even have to let them know. It's really a very educational.
Yeah, that would be even better. Take it out of your entrance requirements.
That's my point.
Put it in your curriculum for the first day of class.
Please do.
That's good.
So, strike. Letter or recommendation from employers. Okay. Interview. Again, in your interview, not really saying what you're doing in there, but if it's selection criteria, then it's got to be rubriced and fair, okay?
Yeah.
And you say no friends or relatives, if you have no reference. So if they're no longer in school and they've never had a job,
that's going to be very hard. That's why.
Well, but that's why we mentioned teachers or mentors. Only because of course, any friend or parent's going to write the greatest recommendation. We just want someone that's a little more honest. Nothing wrong with that either.
Well, if I'm already out of high school, I'm not going to go back to high school and say I've been out 2 years, I haven't done anything with myself, so can you give me a letter of recommendation to say a couple of years ago when I was in school I showed such promise, which clearly I haven't shown because I haven't had a job in 2 years. Would you give me a letter anyway? So then I go to the next door neighbor and say, could you be my mentor? Give me some advice so you can write this letter for me.
So you think it's just...
No, I think you're shooting yourself in the foot.
I think it's fine.
I mean, you do? I agree with Trish on this. Because they're not probably the most academically inclined. They would have gone to university. So they're going to have to go try to find a high school teacher that remembered putting them in.
It shows me some resourcefulness on their
part, too. Same thing with an Eagle Scout application there.
That's why there's 1% of Eagle Scouts.
But not necessarily are they not academically driven, because most schools, as you know, for like dental hygienists, are actually requiring that they have some dental assisting experience school. So if they have some motivation to exceed on, then this would be the beginning steps of their career.
Again, not prescriptive in telling you have to move it.
Okay.
I'm only telling you from my experience because I want you to be successful.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be harder than you think to get 22 students, 11 and 11, that first year. And these are all hurdles that are going to stop people. I know these type of students that are coming for dental assisting. Much different than dental hygiene. They've all gone to college and have prerequisites and, you know, they're
right.
So type A, they know what they're doing, you know, from the get. But dental assisting, no. So it's just free advice. Do what you want on that, okay? Moving on in the catalog to the page number again, but it's cross-reference as 10. That's a student services provided. Are you really going to charge them $100 per hour? And you think they'll have the resources to do that?
It's a deterrent for them not to miss class.
It's a hell of a deterrent. I'm not saying no. I mean, we use similar things in my nursing schools I run. But again, these people generally have more liquidity when it comes to this. And my only suggestion there is you have the will in there, and I think you've heard Ms. Leonard several times saying will means you have to do that. You can't decide not to. So I would maybe suggest putting the student maybe charge $100 an hour.
Okay.
Generally charge $100.
But doesn't that lead us to an issue where you charged her but not him?
No.
Yeah.
With
so you have things like excuse absence. Like if a person has the flu, you don't want them coming to your office. And if you're too strict on your attendance, they're going to come sick. And you're not going to want that to be the case. So you have to decide, just like with your employees, you have to decide what is an excused absence you're okay with and what you're not.
There's a lot of gray area.
Yeah, if you require doctor's notes, that's a problem, because last time, you know, how often do you go to the doctor when you have a cold? Not often.
Right.
So you just have to decide, and you can put whatever you want in there. Just be consistent, and just make sure that you're not shooting yourself in the foot, and you're not having people who end up dropping out because for want of $100.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, and the will is the smiling thing. If you change it up, I'm not saying you can't. It's a good deterrent. You need deterrents, trust me, to keep them to come. But, you know, if somebody, you know, husband fell over dead, you know, are you going to make them charge $100 an hour to come back because they missed the class? Probably not, right?
Right. I'm more worried about the illness because of the
that they're actually on sick.
Anyway, all right. Promise, I'm almost to the end. I'm sure maybe Miss Leonard has some stuff. Miss somebody else has stuff, but I'm almost to the end. I went through your advertising. Again, what I'm looking for is truth in advertising, non-puffery, and all covering. I think it looked pretty good. The only thing I noticed on the second thing in my, I think it's part of the same thing, your flyer.
Uh-huh.
It says tuition covers all expenses except expanded education modules and certificate exams. It does not actually cover all because we just talked about that you charge $100 an hour for makeup. So, so that tuition is not all encompassing for that. So that needs to either be amended or struck.
So it needs to.
It could say tuition would cover all expenses and stuff except for missed time, which is at a rate of $100 an hour, but I wouldn't want to advertise that. But you can't put that it's all encompassing when it's truly not. Okay. Job placement for the placement. Can you explain your job placement? I don't think I have a really good feeling about or a good sense of what you guys are doing for career placement.
Well, if there's any real gray area with regard to what we do, that's just an additional part. When I graduated dental school, nobody said that there was job placement, but they did offer it in the sense of for some people that want to stay in the area or if they had a relationship with doctors in the area based on that community. Well, I moved out of state, so it wasn't an option for me. But it's one of those things where with my reputation and my involvement within the community and the fact that I've been doing this for 20 years, I do feel that I have a great capacity to be able to help place these people. Now, I can't necessarily say if I can place candidate number two.
Well, you can. It's against the rules to say you can guarantee placement.
Right, which I would never insinuate. Yeah. But I'm just saying that I can't. There's no way to really know. I mean, of course, we were going to...
No, that's not what I'm asking. Okay. I'm not saying, are you guaranteeing me 100% placement or you're going to place 100%. What I'm saying is most people for placement have a structured placement department and procedures, how they address places. They're going to help with resume writing. We're going to do this. We develop job leads to help you find interviews. I don't see that addressed. Now, that's what job placement entails. It doesn't entail saying you're all going to get placed. But if you say you're offering and the student goes and you say, I need some help with job placement, you got to be able to help them write a resume, talk about interview skills, give them job leads, help them with all that stuff.
What you just described and what is in your brochure are two different things, and that'll be a concern.
Okay. Yeah. We do mention in one of our modules that we will, of course, be going over resume development and that part of it with regard to module 9 in the catalog.
Yeah.
But are you saying that we should be more specific or are we being too...
All I'm saying is this is to entice students in and say there's a job placement program. That's pretty open-ended. So I'm going to end up looking and saying, what is your job placement program?
Okay, so maybe at least initially we should scratch that from the brochure.
Either scratch it or put a thing in the catalog that says job placement thing. This is what we do. It's just resume writing. We develop local job leads. We says, address it because they're going to be looking for a program. So if you don't want to do any additions to the catalog, then strike that off there as well and then put it in because I know you're going to help your people.
Right.
You're going to want to get them employed. Nobody's going to.
But that is a difficulty for me because I know that some candidates will probably be very strong and some will not.
So with all of us in accredited schools, or at least nationally, that are absolutely be held to placing students. Because let's face it, nobody comes to our type of schools for edification purposes. You don't have John who's been there since 1968. No, they're coming not because they want to go to school, but because they want to be a dental assistant for you.
Right.
That's really where they are. Or they want to be X, Y, and Z. So that's all I'm saying. So either strike that or address it better in the catalog.
Okay. I think we'll take the latter. I think I like the idea of it, but I do realize that something, especially with a beginning business like this, is I do want to develop that. And of course, I think with time, that will be even stronger as our reputation starts to get out there even further. But
yeah, okay. I do too, and I think it's admirable, and I like that schools want to do some career placement. That's what we're all about is the job at the end of the day. So.
One of the best ways to help this situation is like Len said, is to establish those partnerships with other dental offices where you can send your students for clinical rotations or external.
Well, of course, we've informally got that. You know, you educate these people, I'll hire anybody that you send out. Of course, that's talk. But if I can make good on that, I just don't know yet.
Yeah, just don't guarantee it, Dana. You'll do everything, because there's going to be students who you come that are absolute wonks that you can't place, and that's just the reality.
That's why it was vague as vague as vague could be. Job placement program. I know this. I'm kind of kidding.
I'm done with my question.
Having them go to externships in other dental offices, often those folks end up hiring them. So if they do the entire program with you, and then they don't apply at other dentists, that's fine. You would be giving them a reference of some sort for the work that they did there, and they would have graduated. But sometimes by having other dental offices who have signed an agreement with you to take so many folks for the externship, that might actually help you in the job placement, because if they like them, they'll keep them.
My concern there was that it would complicate and involve more people in the process, so I would imagine it comes
down. You'd have to someone to monitor those externships.
Right. Okay.
In the beginning, if you have space to do all of them, that's great.
Yeah.
But you're not going to be able to hire all of them.
No, that's not the intention.
Yeah, and I hope you can do it yourself. It's better if you have to leave. But what my point with that is you don't want an interruption when all of a sudden you do have 22 students and you have no resources to be able to do their education.
Yeah.
And you say, well, wait 2 months. No, that's going to be a problem.
That's before the complaint committee.
Yeah.
Right.
So that it behooves you to get those. It does complicate it in the sense that it's more management from your side of the house, you know.
Okay.
And you don't want people picking your ideas.
My questions are on the lead referrals. You have the tuition discounts for the Study Buddy program. Can they do that? Student who's coming in and they convince someone else to come with them, so they'll give a $500 discount.
Yeah, non-accredited, they can, I think. That's why I didn't bring it up, but maybe I'm wrong.
This just makes me feel weird.
I know.
Like, you feel dirty?
No, I just feel like it's, you know, when I buy a car, and they tell me, give me $500, I get to mess with my car.
Bulldog fee.
Well, and then what does that mean? Is it that they have to complete the first course to get their money, or they have to just to enroll?
They have to enroll.
They have to probably meet a
requirement. That means the requirements of enrollment.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And refunds, out of curiosity, why are you giving yourself only 5 days to make a refund if they fail to return for leave of absence when you can do 30?
I honestly didn't know we could do 30. I mean, this is probably one of my biggest sticking areas, because if somebody drops out fairly soon in the program or the session, we have no way of really filling that position because of the fact that it is such a short program, 3 months, that we wanted to make it as rich as possible. But I honestly didn't know it could be 30 days.
It says on number one, section D,
all
refunds will be issued within 30 days of the determination of the withdrawal.
And at the bottom, you have, it will be done in 5 days.
It says refunds will be issued within 30 days of the date of student notification.
And one of these things, it also says...
Within 5 days of the date of student was scheduled to return, that's when their leave of absence begins.
What?
That doesn't make sense.
No, I mean, I'm reading it. I see where you see the 5 days.
Can you just read the whole paragraph first?
Yeah.
Refunds will be issued within 30 days of the date of student notification or date of school determination withdrawal due to absence or criteria as specified in the school catalog, or in the case of the student not returning from an authorized leave of absence within 5 days of the date the student was scheduled to return from the leave of absence and did not return.
So what that says to me is if I'm supposed to come back on Monday and I don't, you're going to do that refund 5 days from Monday. And you don't have to.
So just change that to 30.
Yeah, typically they just say, or within 30 days of when the school was scheduled to return from leave of absence and failed to do so. So it's the same thing. It's not something extra for the leave. It's just a student who like stops attending, and then you say after 5 days, we're going to kick them out. So there's last day of attendance is the date of determination. So if they stop attending, your date of termination leave and LDA are two different things. But on a leave of absence, it's when they fail to come back. You know that they're gone. They were supposed to come back and they didn't. So the clock starts there. You don't have 5 days and then 30. So just take out the 5 days.
Okay.
That's all I got. Anyone else have any questions, concerns, comments? All right. Would someone make a motion?
All right. To come at that point, then I make a motion to grant the conditional vocational license to Contemporary Dental Academy with the following stipulations: that you maintain a $15,000 surety, that you provide the board an updated certificate of liability insurance with them as the certificate holder for the amounts required by the board, and that you make the required changes to the catalog and the marketing material.
Okay. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Having a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Or do they agree to the
stipulation? Oh, do you agree to the stipulation?
I do.
I'm getting tired.
I know.
Okay, so we'll repeat again. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? And motion passed.
Thank you. Thanks for your patience today.
You can keep doing it yourself.
Good luck to you, all right?
Thank you.
Yeah. We're going to take a 2-minute break and then we'll. All right, we will resume the meeting. The next item on the agenda is the Heart Rhythm Academy. Ms. Cantor, if you could give us a summary.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Heart Rhythm Academy is seeking a non-accredited vocational program license to offer two programs. The first one is a clinic-based cardiac device specialist, and the second one is a cardiac device industry representative. Here, representing the institution is Mr. Andrew Nash, and I know he's messed up her name, and your board member lead is Ms. Flynn.
You can introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Andrew Nash, president of the Heart Rhythm Academy. This is Rhiannon Guffey. She's the admissions advisor for Heart Rhythm Academy.
Would you like to give a brief explanation of what your school's about?
Sure. So Heart Rhythm Academy is, I like to think of it as it's a tool or a resource to bring down healthcare costs in the United States. As everyone's aware of, Obamacare, or it's formerly called the Affordable Care Act, has recently been implemented, and it's changed healthcare significantly. One of the ways it is having an impact is causing hospitals to look for avenues to bring down their costs. One of the second largest cost to hospitals using outside called outside services is cardiac devices, and currently hospitals are working hard with cardiac device manufacturers to try and reduce the cost of these devices. Typically, most people know a cardiac device is a pacemaker. They're also implantable defibrillators and a third type, which is a cardiac resynchronization device. And those devices are, although the hospitals are pushing hard to bring those costs down, it is that manufacturers are having a hard time doing that, because what's been done historically is the manufacturers have done the follow-up, or what they call services, the cardiac services, what they're called, cardiac device clinicians. They've done this work for the healthcare providers. So when an individual gets a pacemaker, for the next 5 to 10 years, that individual needs to be monitored and followed up. Every time that the patient goes to the hospital, or every time it goes to the doctor's office, someone needs to optimize, interrogate, and reprogram the pacemaker. Historically, that's been done by the manufacturers, and that service that is for free, technically for free, and they don't charge at the time they do that service. Where they do is they bake that cost into the device. And so what's happened is the manufacturers are unwilling to bring down the price, because they have to provide this service. And so there's a point at this time where the hospitals are asking them to bring down the price, but the manufacturers are unwilling, and the hospitals are the reason they can't provide this service themselves is because they don't know how. The training on it is very difficult. And so where the school comes in is we are providing potential students. They could be health. They could be in the medical field, allied health professionals, or they could be people without any experience in the healthcare field. We provide that training for them, so then they can go work for the healthcare providers. That program is the clinic-based cardiac device specialist. So once we provide that service for students, they could then go work for hospitals and or physicians. And that's that initial program. The other program, which is the cardiac device representative program, that program is for manufacturers they would hire out of that program. We would train students, and the manufacturers would hire those students to go into their field. That program is, frankly speaking, more to help with the cash flow in the first few years. The future is in the first program I mentioned with healthcare changing. That program is the long lasting program that we want to provide. The second program is there to fund it in effect, because manufacturers need they're the ones providing the free service, so they need trained people. And there's no school on the West Coast that currently does that. There's two schools on the East Coast, but none on the West. So that second program will fund, in effect, the first one. There's a lot of demand for that right now. But as time goes on, the demand for that will go down as this service gets provided by the healthcare providers and not the manufacturers. The school's set up to fill that need that's getting created with Obamacare and otherwise known as the Affordable Care Act.
So currently, the people who do this job are employed by the manufacturers.
Correct.
And you're saying that need coming up for it to be a private, separate position.
Correct.
That's when I had a really hard time following the thread in all this. And I know that you updated some of the stuff, which we're going to have to go through as we're looking at it here. The stuff in the executive summary that you changed, that's fine, thank you. So part of that I was confused of is I'm a student, and I come in and I take this first program, and then I go to the hospital to get a job, and they say, we don't hire people for that. We get it for free.
Right.
How does that work?
Right. Well, that program, the second program, is not being offered until year two.
The first program, though. So the first
cardiac device. I'm sorry. I misspoke. The clinic-based program, clinic-based cardiac device specialist program. Right now, anywhere between 5 to 10% of the services is being done by healthcare providers, and that's where that program
is. There is an existing.
It's very small. It's done in rural areas, and it's done by large groups. So where you have groups of 20 cardiologists, they'll hire their own cardiac device specialists. But what's changing now is that 5 to 10% is going to grow to 50 to 80%. The manufacturers would like to reduce their force, their clinical force, and healthcare providers would like to be able to do it themselves. But there's really right now not a mechanism to do that, and so that's what the school is trying to come in and fit in.
Our concern is the students pay for the program and then there is no job. And then they complain to me and say, they said this is an upcoming career and the job does not exist.
Sure. No. And so I can tell you in Phoenix right now, there's anywhere between 20 to 30 cardiac device specialists, and it's growing. So there is demand for that field. I should say there is supply.
Then at tab 3. On page 7. In the original booklet, it was called referral fee, and now it was changed to placement fee.
Yeah, that's correct.
So you changed now to say for each student that graduates as a cardiac device industry representative and is placed with a parent company. So you're going to collect a placement fee of $15,000. For each student that graduates as a cardiac device specialist, HR will receive place a fee of $1,000. So if you graduate someone and one of these companies doesn't want to hire them, they don't have a job and you don't have the fee.
Correct.
So you're getting paid both ways. You're getting paid by the students and you're getting paid to place them.
That's the intention. That's the intention.
And these companies have agreed to do that?
Yes.
And are they
it's already being done. There's two schools on the East Coast, and they are already paying placement fees.
Okay. And is there a GPA requirement or a professionalism requirement or anything? It's just a matter of if they pass the interview, they'll get the job, and they get the money.
Yeah. A lot of times these companies will hire out of the program before they even finish. So that the requirement is, I would say, at the most, is graduate. For the companies, you know, they get trained clinicians. They're trained reps in two ways. They can either train them themselves or they can hire out of one of these schools. When they train them themselves, it's a cost of about $200,000 because it takes them about a year to do it. So they employ them at full salary for that year. And then there's the cost of just training them. And about 25 to 30% don't pass in their own training. So they look at it like if they hire out of the school, it's a huge benefit because they get people, like it's, you know, employees that have already paid money and already shown that they can clinically do the work. And so they're very interested to hire out the school. In fact, the two schools on the East Coast have what they advertise is a 99% placement rate. It's on their website, but whether that's really true, I don't know.
And I skipped one thing right before that on the tuition. It has that all resources for each program will be provided with tuition and appropriate equipment will be returned at the completion of the program. What's appropriate equipment? How do they know what they can keep and what they have to give back and what happens if they don't give it back?
Yeah, that equipment is, you know, that wording was put in there, but really they're not getting any equipment. We might give them what's called a programmer, and that's used when they go to their externship sites, and so that would be what they'd give them. But we've now just placed the programmers at the externship sites, so we don't have the student. The plan would be to give the students. The plan had changed from having the students carry the programmer to just keeping them at the externship site.
Okay. So you need to fix this because it is confusing. Because you're saying all resources and parentheses, you're saying books, research accounts, necessary medical software, etc. But then you say equipment has to be returned. So I don't know what equipment I got, yes, I'm giving it back. So you just fix it onto 7. And it's worded the same in both the old book and the new book.
Excuse me.
Something that chose to change. You changed the heading, but left everything beneath it the same. It says pacemaker companies. It says cardiac device companies. So I was thinking you took out this section, but you just changed the title. But you've now explained that. I didn't understand how if the other companies were doing it, how does that give you the opportunity for the business model? Like, it's already being done, but somehow you're thinking that gave you an opportunity, and it made no sense whatsoever. But now you've explained why that makes sense.
Okay. Good.
In the marketing plan, underneath the 5 bullets, you have HRA will utilize the following marketing channels and tactics in order to position itself as a go-to resource for certification.
Yeah, that should have been taken out. Any area that mentioned certification or
We intended to change it. If it hasn't been changed...
No, it is changed. I really don't want to know. I just looked at that one here.
I'm sorry, you said it has or has?
It did.
It was, okay.
Yeah, Ms. Stanfield made it very clear to remove all references to certification.
As well. Page 23 has this chart. Page 23 used to start with online courses, on-campus course online courses, and now that part is gone.
Yeah, I think we moved that to just put that in parentheses, that program would be online. In the table beneath it, under Figure 13, I see that page. You see, right below your pen, in the orange or whatever red, it should say online in parentheses, right above your one.
I was looking to see if the part that I objected to was missing. I just wasn't sure if it was the same thing or not. So previously, you talked about it offering a one semester cardiac device represent courses, and now you're changing it to an 8-month program.
Yeah, I got your notes, and we took out semester, and we just put in program.
I didn't have any stickies, so I had to write on pages.
No problem.
Did you give anyone of this part? Program study?
I think there were some changes to that as well. Although I'm not sure. I do know.
I don't see it. I'll just tell you what I have here. So on the program study, you had length and weeks.
Yeah, that was changed. That was a typo. It should be 16, not 14. It says 14.
Well, in one place it says 16. In one place it says 14.
Yeah, it should all be 16.
And somewhere else, it's 41 hours a week. I don't know if I did the math, the program outline. I was trying to figure out what it actually was. So it's 16 weeks?
16, yes.
And how many hours a week? 36?
I think it's a little under 40. Yeah, it's just under 40. Should be 36, 4.5 days.
It was on the program outline that it said 14 weeks. That part was just a typo. Okay.
Yep.
The grievance, did you do that one?
Yes. Yeah, we did that. We made changes to that based on your notes.
Oh, that looks much nicer. It was the longest one I've seen that kind of made it went in circles.
Yeah, it was a circular argument.
And if I recall, that's the one that I didn't have a chance to look at. It didn't have the timeline. It didn't have time frames for...
The one still doesn't?
It, for when you respond. The school is supposed to have a certain period of time to respond to the student, and either it didn't have it or it lost it.
Step two has within 5 business days.
Step three, 3 and 4 did not.
Okay.
It just seems like a very convoluted process as well.
The original one was not even doable.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
And even the first step, the student has a claim involving a peer, faculty member, associate. should speak directly to the instructor. Do you want a time frame in that? Can they complain a year later?
Plus, one other thing is, it might not just be an instructor that they have an issue with. It has to be your staff member.
It says peer, faculty member, or associate.
Okay.
Is that good enough?
Yeah, so there's a time frame for step two, but not for the other three steps. So we'll put a time frame.
And be reasonable with the time, and it's best to do business days. Like at the other school, it said 48 hours, and like, well, what happens on Friday? Are you going to stay and do it on Sunday? Yeah. And you gotta remember, whatever you say, you have to do, or you'll be before the complaint committee, and we really want to avoid that. Circle something later. I don't know what I'm talking about. For some reason, I'm asking, probably because the one program originally said one semester and one said two semesters, and your refund policy is for the whole program. I just want to make sure that for both programs, that the denominator is going to be the program.
Yes. Yeah. It's the denominator is the full hours program.
Okay. Let me just go MOA. Thank you. You know, I have notes. You really did a very nice job. Tab 11. I was just wondering about the time frame. You have the program length is 576 hours.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Tab 11.
Okay.
Should they also have the time period of months, weeks, whatever?
Yeah, I noticed that. So we already have that. We're going to put in 4 months there. And then we will put
in. Why do they have the hours?
Okay, so you don't have to then, if you want to, specify clock hours is perfect, but if you want to also say over 4 months, that would be fine. You don't have to.
We are going to. We noticed that as well, that did not get changed.
On page 3, you're the president, right?
Yes.
So, and student understands, number 6. Information concerning other schools that may accept Heart Rhythm Academy credits towards the programs can be obtained by contacting the Office of the President. So you know everything?
Did
you change that one? I don't know that I have that.
No, I can just give you this one.
You did change it, okay. Perfect. Good job. I think you probably answered this question, but I was asking if there are standard number of hours. Like, how did you come up with the length of these programs?
How? Oh, yeah. You were saying one of your questions is there any standards in the industry? Yeah, there are standards. With the companies that train their employees, generally their training program is 9 to 12 months. It generally takes a year. 10 years ago, I went through a company training program in the cardiac device. I was working for one of the manufacturers. It's right around a year. And then the two schools on the East Coast, they're coming in right at around 8 months. So
40 hours a week for 9 to 12 months is more than 576 hours.
This is for the second program, Cardiac Device Industry Representative Program. The first program, the clinic-based cardiac device specialist program, that's half, and roughly half. And the reason is they're only learning half the skill set. They're learning what's done in the physician's office or in the hospital floor, in the emergency room. They're not going into surgery. And the second program, where it's 8 months, the second 4 months is you're in surgery. The externship program is in surgery, and they're mostly getting trained on surgical procedures.
That's why you added in this industry standard blurb that wasn't there before?
I believe so. We tried to answer that.
Okay. So under the admissions requirements, the ultimate hiring companies, they don't have anything to do with the admissions requirements. That's all on...
No, they don't. I mean, for example, they require a 4-year degree. The manufacturers do. And you can see for our program that the cardiac device rep program, we have a 4-year degree as part of our...
Did they get changed? I see 2 years.
I see 2 years, yeah.
Yeah, that's the first program. That's the 4-month program. That program, though, they'll work for healthcare providers. So the 8-month program where they would go get a job with the manufacturer, that's the 4-year degree. And the first program where you work for a healthcare provider, i.e. hospital or physician, that's an associate's degree of 2 years.
Where is that addressed in your catalog? I only see one set of admissions requirements.
Yeah, admission requirements. I think there's just two. And I noticed that a second ago, but it could be worded better. The second bullet mentions the 4-year degree for the cardiac device rep program. The third bullet says the 2-year degree for the clinic based.
Well, again, do you have an older catalog?
Yeah, what happens? They gave new ones yesterday with two copies, so I have one.
Oh, okay. Because mine doesn't. Since it's my older 2-year.
Yeah, but the requirements are different for both for the programs.
Before you move off of that, can I ask an admissions question?
Did
you change it? It might have been changed, but it says the school reserves the right to choose among qualified applicants. So it's still,
that's still the same.
How are you going to choose?
So we base it off the interview and their transcripts and their background. As I understand it, you can give me some guidance. Trying to be somewhat vague because if we have put something hard and fast, then we can't deviate from that, right?
No, I think it's the opposite for this. You're going to say you're going to choose amongst them. People are going to naturally want to know how, and what we'll want to know in the complaint and how you weren't biased against them. You're going to have to show some non-biased way you stack rank and assign points. Potential points for transcript, potential points for interview, potential
sure.
points for that, and then you take the best out of that. If you leave it too subjective, people can come and say you just didn't like me because of my background, you
sure.
know, or because of who I am, what I look like. So it's got to be, objective, not subjective. I think I said subjective earlier, sentimental one. objective. So you want to come up with some type of good, if you're going to stack rank people to let people in, you might want to do that. And that's not a bad thing, just come up with a very,
Yeah, can I ask a question?
Uh-huh.
Give me some ultimately, we want our main driving force here is we want them to be able to get a job in whichever field they're going into, right? And so when we're hiring somebody, we're looking at it from if they're going to they're in the four-month program and they want to go work for a hospital, we look at it from a hospital administrator's perspective. And so we want to be able to discriminate based on whether we think they can get a job or not. And then going back to the guidance that I heard earlier, and I think Ms. Stanfield mentioned when I met with her, if you say something hard and fast, and then you don't apply that for everybody, then you hold yourself open to complaints as well. Is that correct?
Well, again, you're not a hiring agency. You're a school, so you can't discriminate the way you can maybe when you're hiring and doing something. Then you really can't discriminate when you're hiring either if they meet that. From education, it's a whole different ball game. I mean, I certainly run schools, as I'm sure they do, with competitive programs that only have a limited amount of seats. And
sure.
So we may get, say, I have a program that has 17 seats twice a year. Might get 40, 50 applicants that meet all that. But they have to do essays. They have to do interviews. They have to do transcript reviews. They have to do experience reviews. And each one of those is assigned a point, a maximum point ranking that they do.
Right.
And then they're stack ranked from the best points to the best. Because if not, you are saying, well, I'm just judging that. I don't think you're very good. And that's going to open you up way, it's going to be in front of us and everywhere else. So it's different than being hiring somebody. You're not hiring. Yeah.
Right.
You set your admission standards, and then you got to manage too. Okay?
Okay. Yeah. If we do say something along the lines of that you need to have a GPA of 3.0 or above, then if we accept somebody below that, we hold ourselves up for scrutiny, correct?
Good, but maybe you might say must, you know, or your GPA. I mean, you can set your criteria. A lot of people do. I mean, look, there's probably not a university out there that you won't apply to get your master's degree that have some type of GPA
right.
standard. So I would say that, you
right.
know.
Okay.
So we have to manage. All I'm saying is you have to be fair about that, and you have to be able to explain to somebody, because somebody that doesn't get accepted very well may say, okay, show me what were the criteria and so show you how I stacked and why I'm not there. So.
I think I understand.
Okay, good.
On page 15 in the new updated, it says training and options in the circle.
Yes.
It looks like the wording is the same. The first sentence, the student is not dismissed from the program for failure to learn the required skills. But then farther down, it says, if the student fails the retest, they'll be counseled by the program director as the advisability of continuing in the program.
Yeah, no, so that first sentence, that's a good catch. We made a mistake. That's definitely, student would fail if they didn't learn the required skills. So we'll have to either, I'm not sure where the mistake, if there's one word that was accidentally put in, and then there shouldn't be a not.
Maybe it says that the student may be dismissed.
Yeah, I think exactly. That we want to say the opposite of what that sentence says. So, yeah.
And it also sounds like this program director has godlike power that he can just determine if the person should continue or not. So just make sure that the however these decisions are made, that they are uniform, they make sense, so that we don't have a student coming in saying, me and Johnny were both kicked out for failing, and then they let him come back, they let me come back, and why. So you don't have to give all detailed explanation of how you're doing it. You just need to be prepared to be uniform and non-discriminatory.
Yes, yes. Okay. No, absolutely. We in this Stanfield emphasize that quite a bit. And so if we don't clearly articulate that in here, I know we tried to come up with some passing scores for their tests as they advanced. And a way to weed out anybody who wasn't picking up the skills in an objective way. So that's...
Because this is basically saying that it's subjective. It's not based on their GPA. It's based on this guy or gal. Program director is the one who's going to decide whether they can stay or not. That's the way that section is written.
Yeah, no, I see what you're reading. And I
found a way to do it.
I think what that's trying to address there is... weird is going on about the disrupting or unacceptable behavior in the academic setting, and we need to be more specific about what that looks like, what kind of behavior that would be.
You can always have an outflow or probation deal where if the GPA slips below this, they may be dismissed. However, they can be with program director, see if an academic plan can be devised or something. Which is the way it's written. It sounds like grades don't matter at all. It just matters whether this guy's going to let you stay.
No, that paragraph needs to change because we do have a grading system, and if they fall below it, then that is cause of our dismissal.
Okay, anyone else have any comments, questions?
Not for me, but I didn't ask already.
Quick question. So the program is on ground face-to-face or online?
The program for the cardiac device rep program, that's face-to-face.
Okay.
The program that is going to be for students that will work for healthcare providers, a four-month program, that will be online.
And did you translate somewhere the hours? Because it's 500, whatever the hours are, did you translate that to what in online learning that is?
Yes, there should be a part where it says how much of that is online, call it didactic or just training, and then there's clinical training with that. Because it just means what would they're not doing anything face-to-face, but yes, we broke it apart. There's externship hours, and then there's online hours. We broke it up.
In page 149, it's... So if you could just find that out.
Yeah, it's 320 hours of clinical hours, and then the classroom hours are 256.
But an hour of online is, are you saying that's equal to an hour of face-to-face class?
Yeah, that's the assumption. Is that not accurate?
Not necessarily. There's formulas that people use for face-to-face hours versus, so just maybe research that.
Okay.
Because an online hour is not necessarily the same as a face-to-face hour.
We will. And the majority of that online is in webinars, so it's not asynchronous tutorial
right.
training. It's webinars, but there is some of it that will be tutorials. So I see what you're saying. You're saying maybe one or both of those could not be one-to-one.
Just double-check that.
Yeah.
Just double-check that.
So the conversion to credit makes
Yeah, maybe that's,
yeah.
I just want to call out that learning that someone's doing because face-to-face is a little different in terms of how you're going to.
An hour is a 60-minute period in which 50 minutes of training occurs. You can't take 250 minutes to 100 minutes straight and hold 2 hours.
Say that last sentence. You can't take two.
You can't take 250-minute periods, put them together, and do 100 minutes in a row and call that 2 hours. Because 100 minutes is 1 hour and 40 minutes.
Got
so
it.
When you set the 576, that is effectively, it's actually 576 hours, you can give 10-minute breaks. This is for when you're doing it in seat. And when you do it online, you just have to be able to show that that's the equivalent work. Like people may go at a different pace, they may go slower or faster when they're doing the work online, but you have to be able to show that it is the equivalent work.
That's good.
This just a quick thing. Page 140. Well, it's page 149 of the PDF.
Okay.
And it's the refund amount and percentage of clock hours. And one of them is called the implant program. The other is called the follow-up program.
Yeah. Like, those are the implant program is the cardiac. Yeah.
Yeah,
so that's they have different titles.
Yeah. That's all.
Yeah. Absolutely. So. And what page was that?
149 of 231 on the PDF.
149. What was the last number?
231.
Okay.
That's the old.
Yeah.
The old draft.
Yeah. No. Okay. We'll make sure that it's consistent.
Any other questions?
So right now you own a company called Set Solutions.
Yes.
And what does that company do?
So actually, it's sales. Cardiac devices. It's a medical device sales.
All right, so you're not training anybody in that company. You're okay. I kind of read it that it was like you're training people in that company too. Okay.
Yeah, no, I have sales reps and clinical reps, so that's how I'm familiar with the industry.
Very good.
The reason there's not a lot of people out there doing this is because there's a very small field, a small amount of people that know the business side of it and know the clinical side of this business, of this industry. Most people that are in it are working for the manufacturers. Anyone that does know the business side is working for a manufacturer and is, say, has the golden handcuffs on them, so they can't go start a business like this. I happen to be one of the few that I'm independent. I have a I'm called an independent representative, so I'm allowed to go start other businesses. They phased most of those people out, and I managed to stay and retain that tax entity, so to speak. So I have the freedom to go do something like this.
So this is a little bit like, I mean, you compared it to the boot camp there. I mean, it really is. It's really sort of, you know, for computer technology, this is really a boot camp to possibly a good job if you're very clear on the learning outcomes and what
right.
someone needs, right?
Yes. There's a lot for that. There's a lot of people that want to go work for the manufacturers.
Yep.
They get paid a lot of money.
Yep.
And so it's hard to get in. And of course, spending money on tuition and coming and learning it is an avenue. Okay. And so, but ultimately, it's going away. These reps will go away. It's days gone by. Healthcare's changed. Can't afford to pay reps $200,000-$300,000 to go around and do what a basic electrician does, which is kind of what's happening. So
there are just an FYI, there are some of the boot camps that I think have done a good job of clarifying admissions, likely to be successful doing that and getting high placement rates, but they're doing it all on the front end, and they really are, you know, making sure that they interview the people coming in, and so there might just be some best practices for you there and
yeah.
what you're doing.
No, if there are other fields that you're saying companies exist, vocational schools exist like this, I would absolutely yeah. reach out to them. If you know of any, you're saying you know they exist.
You mentioned one of them in there.
In the business plan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm aware of those.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
That's just FYI. That's not official.
No, that's good. It's good feedback. So yeah, so this is a little unique vocational school. It's a little different. There's a need for it, and hopefully we'll have a good run.
Any other questions, concerns, or comments?
No.
Okay. Would that sound like to make a motion?
Sure.
Someone like to make a motion?
Sure.
I make a motion to approve the conditional vocational program license application with a stipulation that the $15,000 surety bond be maintained, that a change be made to the reference to equipment and the tuition and fees, and that the student complaint grievance procedure be changed to include the time frames for each of these steps. Second, anyone?
Second.
Do you agree to the stipulation?
Yes.
Having heard a motion and a second, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Hearing none. Motion passed. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
We learned something. It's very interesting. Hopefully it will work out well for you.
Thank you.
And remember, you don't want to come back to the public.
I don't want to be here at 2 p.m. in the
first place, my
career. You'll have a little bit.
Yeah.
Person. Okay, call to the public. Do you have something to say, sir?
I do.
Board business, executive director's report.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, I give you in my executive director's report, I give you a listing of the programs that have been approved by staff. We approved change of locations and closed schools. Also, gave to you the those schools that are in teach out. Also, as you know, the board's continuation bill was signed by the governor on May 12th. Also, HB 2613, which was a bill that included several changes to other licenses, also included the exemption for the yoga teacher training programs, was signed and goes into effect. effective June 30th. The institutions, there are, and I gave you the spreadsheet that I had done on them. The spreadsheet showed we had 29. To date, 4 have determined to keep licensure. They see value in it. About 7, because it changes, about 7 have determined to keep it through their particular cycle. The remainder, there's 2 I have not yet heard from. There are a good possibility that they may keep their, they may maintain it. That's the indication I have gotten from them. They could, of course, change their mind. And the others will relinquish their licensure effective June 30th. Then also I give to you the listing of those institutions who are have additional actions that have been taken against them. Also, we had a, as you are aware, ACICS's fate looms on Thursday. The department did reach out to all the states. We had a conference call that, since I was here, Kevin went, and conference call was at noon today with the department and all the states I assume were on. I had shared with them that Excel spreadsheet that I gave to you that showed what institutions were ACICS. And the potential impact of students is almost 12,000. Is it still 18 months?
Correct.
They have, okay, so if NACI decides to withdraw the recognition, they'll have 18 months to find another crediting agency.
After the appeal, they have the right to appeal.
After the appeal?
After the appeal has been exhausted, whatever that is, that's 18 months from that point in time. Them to find it out.
So they can appeal and then it goes back to the secretary again.
Correct.
It doesn't go through a judge like it does on some of the others. So that process is totally different than other actions taken by the department where it goes before the judge. My concern, a lot of the schools, as you said, were in teach out. Some of them would be done by then, some wouldn't. I hope that they will take that into consideration, as well as what happens if they cannot find another accrediting agency. Of those are schools that have issues that I don't think the other accrediting agencies are going to be willing or able to take.
And they might be inundated, too.
They'll be inundated, yeah. There's you know, and there's heightened scrutiny, so... potentially, this could have a pretty big effect on us. Anything else?
The information from the department mentioned that there's about 310,000 students that are impacted potentially by this.
310.
Not the 600 or 800,000 that is being the number that's out there. Those are the ones that are specifically associated with Title IV institutions that are getting Title IV. About 311,000 students, somewhere in that range. And they gave us some things that maybe we can talk about off the record about things that we need to do to prepare as a state agency.
On that depressing note,
yeah, really.
This meeting is adjourned at 1:39.
What?
49.
Is it not?
49.
49.
49.